your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Good morning, you beautiful bunch of Fockers, and welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. It is Friday, March 15th. We are here live. It's time for a Friday free-for-all. We will focus on technology and efficiency, but you can call and talk about anything you want. Maybe we'll have a little fun today before the weekend. It looks like I've got Joel with me. I think we're going to have Henry and Alec today. So I'm going to bring Joel in right now, and we'll just get started on some stuff. Joel, good morning.
Good morning, Kevin. How are you?
I am doing wonderful. Did you happen to see any of the posts about the super truck and some of the responses?
I did. Of course, a lot of it got ridiculous. Also, I don't know, at like 3 o'clock this morning, I had a brainstorm, and I've been up furiously writing notes and doing some calculations,
Joel,
for today's
right
show.
Stop right there.
Okay.
I opened my eyes this morning at 2:47 and thought, I feel like I'm wide awake and like I slept all night. I thought, but it is, that's insane. I can't get out of bed at 2:47 in the morning. So I laid there for about a half hour and thought, and I had the same thing, all kinds of ideas. And I thought, I might as well just get up because I'm clearly not going back to sleep. What are the odds that both of us did that?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I coming fast and furious, and I thought I got to get up and start writing this down, or I'm going to forget it all by the time the show starts. So I've just been going at it. So,
well, you may have been so busy. Did you see the post I put up this morning, the million-dollar idea?
I did not.
That's what I worked on all morning. So we'll talk about it here in a little bit. So, what was on your mind this morning that got you up early?
All right. So last night before I went to sleep, I was listening to Tuesday's show when you guys were talking about, you know, downspeeding, piston speed. And it's pretty clear there's a very fundamental lack of understanding on what goes into downspeeding or what it is. And I think you'd made the point several times that you can't look at one measurement. You have to look at the entire rotating assembly holistically to understand really what's going on. And this morning I broke down the stroke and the diameter of the cranks and how that affected the surface speed of the bearings. And I've done it on the mains, and then I also done it for the rods. And we looked at the average piston speed and how many feet per minute, you know, the piston's traveling, and then broke it down into RPM categories to try to, I don't know, maybe explain this so people are starting to understand it. It seems to me that, you know, there's a lot of confusion about this. And, you know, I know Bruce has said a couple of times, well, there's not that much difference between this. You know,
right.
We've all of us that have been around like a small block Chevy, like a 350 Chevy, when we bore that out 30,000ths of an inch, we pick up, what, 21, 22 horsepower? Pretty significant gain on 30,000ths of an inch.
Of an inch,
yeah. 30,000ths of an inch. So this, as you correctly said and pointed out, this is a game of thousandths of an inch to make these concepts work. And, you know, there's also some design considerations in the crankshaft that I'm sure a lot of people have never thought about before. I'm not sure many people spend their evenings thinking about, you know, bearing surface speed on a crankshaft. You know, and this stuff's all important to understand when you're going to run an engine at low RPM. And so I put some stuff together that hopefully we can get through today. Hopefully it's understandable. I was in a rush when I put it together, but, you know, it's kind of frustrating that we know the overall concept that it saves fuel, but nobody can really explain why it saves as much fuel as it does, why when we take a Volvo truck and we spec it one way, it's just ordinary, but we spec it downsped the way it should be, and it's extraordinary. And nobody's been able to really get out there and say, here is why this occurs. And I think I've been able to do that. Some pretty eye-opening numbers that I rolled through this morning. If we have time and you're so inclined, I'd like to go over that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was kind of working on the other end of this. I crunched a bunch of numbers on why we spend all this time on fuel mileage and we haven't stopped. And you've been doing this for 30 years and I was doing it for 30 years. We're still learning. I mean, I just went over, I was talking to somebody the other day and I was kind of going over when I hit certain fuel mileage, you know, kind of milestones, like eight, then nine, then I missed 10. Our second signature truck project, which was supposed to do 10, I made a couple significant mistakes, not in the design of the truck. The design of the truck was solid. I didn't stay as hands-on as I should have, and a couple things went wrong in the build, and then I made a mistake of selling the truck to a husband and wife team that had no experience. They had lots of money. They had lots of assets. They really wanted to own a truck, and they begged me to build this thing for them. And the lack of experience hurt, and the mistakes in the build hurt. And we got really close, then something went wrong, and they took it to another shop and started tweaking stuff, and they put a tiny little turbo on it and choked it down to nothing, and everything just went wrong from there, and it just got worse. We never did get the 10, but you and Henry and, you know, a bunch of other people have done that now. But as I was going through the numbers, for me, for some reason, I went back through my records, and there was like this dry spell through the 90s where I wasn't gaining much at all. I don't remember if maybe I just wasn't working on it as hard, or I wasn't coming up with any new ideas, but I thought it was kind of odd that going from 8 to 9 took me almost like 7 or 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
But so I'll start with the numbers that I crunched to show the potential of this. The other reason I started this was, you know what happens every time you post anything about fuel mileage. Well, yeah, but you cherry picked. You were going downhill from Denver to Kansas City with no...
One second here. Here is a phrase that changes everything from an owner-operator's perspective. And no matter how much data you collect and how you package it and how often you put it out there, all you have to do is say, I call bullshit, and it's all nullified. That's all you have to say. And you don't even have to have any credentials. You don't have to post any of your data. All you got to do is get up and say, I drive trucks and I call bullshit, and automatically your data doesn't mean anything. I always get a kick out of that when they say that. I'm like, okay, whatever.
Or I got several of the responses, well, I pull a car hauler, well, I pull heavy, well, we can't get fuel mileage, so I don't bother. So that was when I went back and said, okay, let's do the comparison here. And I took a truck getting 4.5 miles to the gallon, pretty common for car haulers, heavy specialized. You see a lot of those trucks stuck in that 4, 4.5. We consistently get those guys up to 6, but I said, I'll just go to 5.5. We can do that all day long with half our brain tied behind our back. I mean, we know exactly what to do first, and getting that first mile per gallon when you're at 4.5 is not all that difficult. Mm-hmm. So then I took it one step further, and I'm going to walk through the fuel savings here, but then, and this has always been my philosophy, and this is what I teach. Look, you're getting 4.5, and you seem to be happy because you're not trying to get any better. And if that's the case, I'm going to show you how to make that extra mile per gallon. And since you don't need the money, we're going to invest it in the S&P 500 throughout our career. Mm-hmm. And what could we come up with? Well, first off, the interesting number, let's compare how much more powerful it is to do this when you're at 4.5 miles per gallon. And then I'm going to take all these numbers, savings, what happens if we invest it, and I used you. Well, what happens if we're already at 10.5 and we get to 11.5? Is it as powerful? You and I both know it's not, but man, is it shocking when you start looking at the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So current fuel mileage, 4.5. Fuel mileage goal, 5.5. The numbers I used to make all of these calculations are 110,000 miles a year. If you do more miles, this becomes bigger, but that's a pretty conservative number. $4.02 a gallon for fuel. That was today's price. And on the investments, the lifetime return of the S&P 500 is 9.81%. And that's what I used. And that is 100 years of history. So the truck that goes from 4.5 to 5.5 on 110,000 miles a year saves $17,866 in fuel.
Yeah.
Almost $18,000. Now, to compare that, your truck going from 10.5 to 11.5, only, and I say only, I mean, this is still money, but it's only $3,600.
Uh-huh.
And if we think about it, you are to the point where getting another mile per gallon, we don't even know how we would do it right now. We would need some kind of new technology, some kind of new strategy. It would be really, really difficult and probably expensive. Now, maybe, you know, the new Volvo design, maybe you'll get there. That would be really nice. But we know we might have to spend a lot of money to get that last mile per gallon for you. We don't have to spend much at all to get the mile per gallon for the 4.5 mile guy.
Well, and what you're talking about right here, that just kind of, to me, demonstrates the value when I'm putting out information, when Henry's putting out information, when Steve Krohn's putting out information, all the hypermilers, when they put this information out there for free and people just want to beat it up, right there it kind of demonstrates the value that it can make to the guy, you know, that's getting 4.5 or 5, that doesn't really believe anything more is possible. You know, we're still pushing and pushing and pushing because we're addicted to it, obviously.
Right.
And, you know, we're only going to get $3,600 out of the deal. And we're giving that information away for free, for the most part, to the owner-operator crowd. Now, I'll be straight up. I have found a way to monetize this within the OEMs because they want this information too. Much easier for OEMs to pay for this, charging anybody anything. And you just get all this hate from people. Oh, you're just screwing people, and it's this and that. But look at what you just said. Look at the impact it has to the potential impact it has to somebody's life and livelihood.
Wait till we talk about the numbers if we invest the savings. But to piggyback on what you just said, I made this post, and I said, if you will just retweet this for me, because I'm really trying to grow my X following, if you will retweet this and send me your numbers, I'll run this calculation for you and send it back to you. I'm not going to charge them anything. Help me out a little bit. I'll help you out. Let's go through. So here are the raw savings over time. What I mean by raw savings, it's just how much you didn't have to spend on fuel. We haven't invested anything yet. We're just taking the savings and sticking it in the bank. It's just sitting there. Then I'll talk about what happens if we invested in the S&P 500. So the savings per month are $1,488. Wouldn't that be nice to have almost $1,500 more dollars every month?
Every month, yes.
Every month. 5 years, we're at $89,000. 10 years, we're at $178,000. 20 years, we're at $357,000. And 30 years, which you and I have both spent 30 years doing this, many people do, $536,000 in savings.
Well,
you could have bought
that?
Three trucks with your savings over that time. Three of your trucks could have been free.
Kevin, listen, you're just hauling freight that's too cheap. You're doing all this work, and that's the problem. Your freight's just too damn cheap. Well, you don't need that money. I mean, who needs it, right? Oh, Jesus. That should be eye-opening to people, but for some reason it's not, and I don't understand it.
I know. So now let's talk about the real magic here. This, to me, when I did this calculation, it blew me away. Now, this idea, I remember the first time I got this idea, and it was another one of those wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning. It was the first time I got invited to speak at a Landstar BCO day. It was in the 90s sometime. I don't remember the year. And I was nervous. I didn't do a lot of speaking back then. I was always nervous. I couldn't sleep. We got a couple hours, and I had like 4 seminars to do the next day. And I said, I just got to get up. I can't sleep. And I had an idea. And it was I called it the $1 million idea. And it was save 1 mile per gallon, invest the savings, and have $1 million in your retirement account at the end. But I used, really average conservative numbers so it would kind of apply to everybody. And I shocked myself when I did this on the 4.5 mile per gallon truck. Listen to this.
It's always a good thing.
When you invest your savings for 5 years, we don't end up with $89,000. We're now at $108,000. We didn't have to work anymore for any of this money. All we did was put it in a different account. Instead of the bank, we put it in the S&P 500. At 10 years, we have $282,000. At 20 years, we break the million dollar mark. And if we hold out and leave it in there for 30, $2.8 million. Because we got one more mile per gallon.
There is so much opportunity in the trucking industry when you operate efficiently. It's absolutely mind-blowing that the majority of people in our industry have no clue. Absolutely no clue what you just described. And that is not far-fetched. It is not that is reality. What you just described is reality. And I guarantee you, you're going to have I call bullshit. You're going to have all kinds of those that, nope, it ain't right. It can't be. You know, everybody's so negative. They'll give you 50 reasons why you can't do something, you know, and it's the people that stay positive, they think positive, like you're doing here, like I'm doing with some of the mechanical things that really help to drive the industry. But my God, we just catch so much flack at times. You just want to just say, what am I doing this for? But I don't know, they just didn't think about it a little bit more. And then you're like, it's going to help some people. There's a silent majority out there. I'm sure of that, you know, they take this information and they actually put it to use. And then you get the trolls and the bitchers that are always going to complain about it. But absolutely impressive and absolutely doable. I'll tell you, this is exactly the type of things that me and my brother and sister-in-law were thinking about, you know, many moons ago when we really kicked off Ploger Transportation. We saw these same things, and we knew that it all hinged on efficiency. You had to be efficient in order to achieve this. And, you know, what you may see as small incremental gains in efficiency, it's kind of like aerodynamics exponentially down the road. It's huge for you, even though it seems like an itty bitty number up front, and kind of like what we're struggling with the mechanics of the engine. We look at it and say, well, it's just a little number. It doesn't mean much. It does when you calculate it out. The same thing is happening on the financial side. And I think you're really demonstrating that well.
Well, one of my favorite sayings is people who say it can't be done will be interrupted by people doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. there is no doubt about that. And the people that are doing it are busy doing it, so a lot of times they don't have the chance to get vocal and, you know, sit down and talk about exactly what's going on and how they achieve things because they're busy doing it, right? That's kind of the problem that we have, I think, that to get the message out, it's hard to get those people active because they are so busy succeeding.
And then I'll make a request. Nobody's going to listen to me anyway, but I'll make the request. If you want to challenge or even just question me about the numbers, if you're just confused, call me by all means. If you want to challenge me, don't do it online. Call me. Doing it online is such a waste of time. I don't even want to respond to people who will just jump in. I did hear one of the most original lines I've heard about this in a post yesterday. The guy obviously really lost his marbles over this whole thing because he was nasty right from the very – his line, I should probably – you and I, the crew, you and I and Joel and Alec, I think I'm going to make T-shirts with this saying. He said, I'm not going to jack off the fuel mileage and drive an ugly truck. That's original.
Yeah, that's intelligence on display right there.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say. You know, what people don't understand, they mock. And it's clear that this person doesn't have an understanding of efficiency, fuel efficiency, how it makes your life better, how it just improves every aspect of your life, really. You know, you have financial freedom. It reduces your stress. There's so much upside to it. And for somebody to say something like that, hopefully they're a company driver, because if they're not, you know, they're going to have a very difficult time, especially
soon.
In the down market. Yeah, they will be soon. There you go. I like that.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
You know, that was a lot of fun, and it is powerful. But Joel, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but I got to tell you, this isn't so great for you. If I run all those, I'm not going to go through all the numbers, but if I run all the same calculations and you do the same thing, and this is powerful too, but even this, when you hear it, there's a couple ways you could look at this number. At the end of 30 years invested in the S&P 500, instead of 2.8 million, you only get 581,000.
Damn it.
Yeah. Now, it's still a lot of money, but
now,
the point I want to make with this is the people that get here, and like you said, we're so obsessed with this, we still want one more tenth, and the results are great, but not for the kind of work you got to put in when you get to the point you are. But it's the guys who could make the 2.8 million that always say, I can't get any fuel mileage, why bother?
And here's the thing. Think of how many guys that are in the same type of duty cycle that I'm in that are getting 5.5 and 6 miles a gallon that could be getting 10.5. Now run those numbers and see where they're at.
Yeah. I actually started to do exactly that, and I ran out of time.
Yeah, no, them numbers will be just overwhelming, I'm sure. It's going to be a big number that will surprise a lot of people. And, you know, I have people that call and fight, well, there's no way this is fraud because it takes X amount of horsepower to move X amount of weight, and there's no way can do what you're doing. And I'm like, you really want to have this argument?
Yeah.
I'm more than happy to have it, but let's take it offline if we're going to do it, because I don't know. I just don't understand.
Well, you know, a response like that, all of a sudden the truck driver, what, you just turned into a mechanical engineer?
That was my thought exactly. The one guy's just ripping me to shreds, and you know, I'm been pushing back on stuff, you know, and say, some people see it and they go, oh, that's just mean and nasty. But, I mean, I am getting just beat up by these trolls constantly, and they make statements like this. They don't know what they're talking about. They can't back it up. And when I click on their profile and look at it, like the one guy has this extended hood Western Star that's about as aerodynamic as a brick, and he's going to start to tell me how much power and energy I can get out of an ounce of diesel fuel. Just stop. It's just, like, come on.
Well,
really?
Well, I just thought about something. As much as I know about this, and I don't know about you, but I know for me, as much as I know about this, and it's a lot, if you asked me, based on how many BTUs are in a gallon of fuel, to calculate that all the way out to the end result, I wouldn't even know where to begin.
Oh, it's a long process.
Yeah,
I've been in the room with some people that have done that, and it's not an easy thing to do. And
it
I just have
be.
My doubts whether average Joe truck driver can do those calculations with any degree of certainty. I'd put a guy like Alec on that, and he'd probably come back to me in a week with the right answer.
Right.
But he would spend an entire week, 10 hours a day, probably coming up with that. But yeah, it's nuts. It's just nuts. And I mean, some of the basic stuff that I want to go over on the downsped mechanics of downspeeding. This is just basic stuff. And I mean, it takes a lot of time to put this stuff together and really truly figure it out and understand it, so you know it has an organic feel to it where you just know it instinctively. I know I've listened to you over the years now that we've been talking about this, and you're getting much, much better on your kind of organic understanding of what we have going on in terms of downspeeding. I can remember listening to you right off the bat, and you were struggling for a while. You're getting much better, much, much better. And hopefully today we can clear up some things.
Yeah, I'm getting there, and I'm going to keep working on it. And now that it's starting to make sense, the understanding will come even faster. For a while there, it just was not clicking with me at all.
Yeah, and you know, what's kind of funny is when I talk to some of my retired engineer colleagues that I trust and they really understand this stuff. The other day I was having a conversation with one about some of the stuff that I'm putting together here, and he goes, yeah, you're kind of slow, but you're starting to get it. I was like, thanks, pal. Jesus Christ.
Well, I'm glad he's not listening to me on the radio.
He's a great guy, but he's just blunt and forward. He's always been that way. And he goes, yeah, you're kind of slow, but you get there. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
But, Oh, shoot.
I'm a little dense, but I'm trying.
we're getting there anyway, but it is a complicated subject, and it is not easy to understand. And there are hundreds of variables, and you try to balance things, and you know, there's no one measurement or one design feature that you can point to in any engine that says, well, this makes this superior because it has this. But there are some generalizations we can make, and we can look at, and this is what I've done. I took some of the old school or more traditional engines with traditional power curves, and then we're going to look at some features of the crankshaft and the connecting rods and talk about what we talk about, you know, as far as the angle of the rod and whatnot. And I'm hoping that this becomes a little more clear the way I lay this out. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. It might just confuse people even more. But hopefully when we're at mats, we can all get together and we can maybe plot out a strategy on how we can put together some information here to make this easier to understand.
So one of the things that can really, really help, and I struggle with this all the time, fuel tax used to be one of these concepts that if I was just saying it, I would say it over and over and over, and I swear the more I said it, the more I confused people. And and that is a simple concept of what we're talking about here. They're not even close, but I struggled with that for years. Finally, I went and made a course online and said, look, go look at the course, because I could fill out fuel tax forms so it would start to make more sense when you can look at the form and see the differences. And if you bought your fuel properly with the strategy I was teaching, or if you didn't, if you did what most people do, is they kind of just buy fuel wherever they are when they happen to need it. Really plan trips around fuel purchases, or plan fuel purchases around trips. So I just made a comparison of here's what happens on your fuel tax. And then the other concept that was always hard to get across to them was, even though I'm teaching you and talking about fuel tax, the savings is not in the fuel tax. The savings is in the fuel purchase, but that would confuse the hell out of them too.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you. Yeah, this can all be confusing. I think I've got this broke down into simpler terms. I'm not going to say easy terms, because, like you said, all of this mechanical stuff can be pretty confusing. But you know, as I listen to the discussions, which is very helpful, like when I listen to you and Bruce talk about this, I can hear what Bruce isn't quite understanding. I can hear what you're not quite understanding. And then I can kind of focus on, okay, what's the answer here? So that is extremely helpful. I mean, I love it when you two go back and forth about this. I get it that Bruce isn't quite picking it all up. You don't quite have it all, but it's very helpful to me to listen to that conversation so I can concentrate on areas that seem to be problematic.
You know what I was really encouraged about this week when Bruce and I talked about it?
Okay.
I heard the change in his tone of voice and attitude about it. He went from just kind of blowing it off, which I tend to do sometimes if I'm just so lost on a topic. I don't even want to hear it. That can't be right. I don't get it. And that's been Bruce's attitude up till now. I heard that change on this call, and now he's curious. And when Bruce is curious, he will learn this.
Good, because now he will dig through a lot of things and will look at a lot of individual numbers, but until somebody can help him put it together holistically, it's going to be baffling still. And that's where you pull your hair out. I really struggled with this at the beginning. We would talk about a specific dimension or a specific component, and then I'd look at another one, and it was bigger or better, or, you know, I thought it was different, so it was better, and it is confusing. There is no doubt about that. But I'm hoping I can lay some things out here.
Yeah, he's still struggling. But again, the difference was, and you probably heard him, every time I was trying to get a point across or a little bit of understanding, he says, well, I'm going to go Google bore and stroke. And I'm like, Bruce, don't do that. Don't do that. That will make things worse right now. And then I said something else, and he came back and he said, look, I Googled bore and stroke, and he started comparing
almost all the same.
I'm like, Bruce, no, just don't do this.
Right. You can't do that. It doesn't work that way. So when you talk about this, and I probably had put this out there incorrectly where I talk about rod length. It's actually a rod to stroke ratio is what you're after, not just the length of the rod. It has to be that ratio of the rod length to the stroke. And it's really important that it's looked at as a ratio and not just an individual measurement. And then it starts to become apparent, you know, what's happening, I think. And I know that this is important. I mean, when you look at my last IFTAs, and I posted those, and I'll just go over them here because this, you know, I'm not trying to toot my own horn or say how great I am, but this is what is possible in the real world. And so the first couple of IFTA reports, I was doing my dedicated round. And so from, so from 123 to 323, my IFTA was 11.30. And from 423 to 623, my IFTA was 10.67. And that was all furniture. It was lighter weight, but it was multiple stops, and the back hauls were generally heavy.
Yeah.
So then we get from 723 to 923. I was running solo, just running Schneider stuff. And this is what I consider general van freight. This is what most people pulling van freight, I think Schneider is a great snapshot for what average is, right?
Yeah.
I done 11.08 over 29,938 miles on the
FW. Wow.
Then Travis came in. We were running team. So from 10/23 to 12/23, we ran 45,325 miles at 10.54 miles to the gallon going into the wintertime. And the only reason I'm able to achieve this is because I have an understanding of the downsped concept, why it works, how it works, and how I leverage the advantages. And we've had a lot of discussion about should you watch a boost gauge or shouldn't you. I've got something for you in that regard. And hopefully Bruce will hear this and he'll start scratching his head on this one as well.
Good.
I think it'll at least get him thinking about things. So, yeah, definitely got some interesting stuff for us.
So I've got another idea about this, too, because, again, we can do this as many times as we want on the radio. We're probably going to help a couple people start to understand it. Again, the real power is, images of the things we're talking about side by side, videos. There's really good videos we found out there.
Yep.
What do you think about you and I and Alec working on a so the CMC coming up next week at Louisville, we're kicking it off that live day and a half. And there's no way I have enough time to get into anything like this. In a day and a half when I'm trying to cover all kinds of business concepts, I'm going to touch on things like here's why fuel economy is so important and go over numbers because that gets people excited rather than try to make them sit, through this kind of stuff that might be confusing. But the CMC program is now a year long. So we can spread things out. We can take time. It will be a virtual, which sometimes is actually better than a live in-person. In a live in-person, I know it's nice to get together and see people and all that stuff, but you always run into some issues like somebody can't see the screen right. I can't, no matter how hard you try, you can't get some of these images to show up on that big screen the way you want them to. People are talking, so somebody misses something. The beauty of virtual training, if you're good at presenting it, and I've done a lot of them and I'm getting better all the time, is you eliminate a lot of that stuff. I can size things so that you can absolutely see it on your screen right in front of you. You can be in a place where you're not distracted. We don't have issues with noise and all kinds of other things. So I would love if you and Alec and I can get together and put together a piece of the CMC on all this.
Yeah, I think it would be a fun project, and I think it's really needed because even at the big fleet level, they struggle to understand this. I'm working with folks at Pepsi, and they're having a very difficult time. They have a dedicated fleet engineer. He is a very smart gentleman, and he is kind of struggling understanding why I kind of want to push him towards the iTorque versus running direct drive. He's got some concepts that he's developed over the years, kind of stuck in his head. And I'm going to have a nice training session with the folks at Pepsi at the end of next month. And I'm actually going to work with some of the drivers one-on-one and then hopefully work with their engineers as well to kind of explain some of these concepts that we're going to talk about.
Hearing that he's an actual fleet engineer and this is kind of his job, I don't feel so bad that I'm struggling with it then.
No, trust me. Look, I'm not throwing any names out here, but even internally, when I talk to some of the engineers that are not always directly involved with the engine, they struggle, and everybody does, because this stuff is not it's not stuff you talk about every day. And unless you've got a background like John Walko in racing, you're going to have a very hard time to really wrap your head around this and for the light bulb to come on and say it makes sense. Now, in terms of Bruce, now that he's becoming a little more open-minded to this, hopefully a few of the things that we touch on today, it'll get him thinking.
Yeah, yeah. And like I said, I finally heard that shift where he went from, I'm not getting this, so I'm just going to blow it off, to now I kind of, maybe I'm starting to get it and I'm curious. And I will tell you, Bruce is one of the most curious people I know. And it's why he is where he is today, because he will work until he figures something out. And he also, I've spent a lot of time with Bruce. We've traveled together. We've gone on vacation together. And I have never seen anybody who will walk up to a total stranger and just start asking them questions. And he will, it's like he interrogates people sometimes.
Oh, that's funny. Well, if you want, I can start.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you want, I can start on a couple of these and just roll through just a few of the points that I came up with and just kind of let people digest it and, you know, go from there. I don't know that we'd want to go through all of this. I got 8 or 10 pages of calculations in front of me. So.
Yeah, let's take it a page at a time so we don't overwhelm everybody. But I do want to hear this, so let's do that now. Are you on a headset with a boom?
I am.
If you could just move it down a little bit, we're getting the breath noise.
Okay. How's that?
And I don't know if it's just me hearing it because I've got a headset on and I've got it turned up pretty loud, but it would help, I think, if you move it down to like where your chin is. It still picks up really well, but it won't pick up that noise.
Yep. Is that better?
Yeah. Let's go because I got my pencil and
paper here. Okay. So, you know, one of the things that everybody kind of understands is the stroke on a crankshaft. That, you know, people kind of understand what's going on there. And, you know, traditionally we've always thought that longer stroke makes more torque, and it does. Longer stroke engines can produce more torque, but it's not the only way that we produce torque. We can make torque by adding boosts, increasing dwell time, and increasing the injection duration. So there's multiple ways that we can actually increase torque. It doesn't all have to be through just stroke. The longer the stroke of an engine, the faster the average piston speed is going to be, and the faster the maximum piston speed is going to be. And that's important to understand as we get into this. We also have to understand that 40% of all engine friction comes from that piston moving up and down in the cylinder. That's a lot. I mean, that's almost
can
half
I stop
of the
you right there.
Sure.
And I, if you were listening, I'm sure you heard Bruce mention this, and he's brought it up a couple times, and he has a good perspective on this, and I maybe want to understand why, because I'm not exactly sure if I do. Bruce has pulled a million engines apart. He knows how everything works in there. He's done all kinds of experiments. Bruce has developed, you know, multiple products to improve engines over the years, you know, going all the way back to mechanical engines and fuel pumps. And I forget exactly which engine was. They determined that the single fuel line coming in the back, by the time it got to the front cylinders, it had lost a lot of pressure. And Bruce developed a kit that split the fuel lines and send the fuel from both sides. I mean, some pretty incredible stuff. So he does get this kind of stuff. He's just never been exposed to this idea. But he said, we've checked this. We've gone back and we've looked. And he said, we pull engines apart all the time. He said, we have never found that there is increased wear where it should be if we've got this side loading of the piston.
Well, no, because here's why you won't see the wear. Of course, the engineers understand they have more side load there when they designed that rod angle to thrust up against the piston, so the piston has a bigger skirt. So it spreads it out over a bigger area, and you'd get increased wear, but you still have increased drag.
That
because
makes
it
sense.
Spreads out over a bigger area. So when you have a big bore, like the Cummins is, it has a bigger piston with a bigger skirt area, you're not going to see any increased wear, but you have increased drag, and there's no way around that.
Well, that
bigger
makes
bore
sense.
Engines, and when you side load and thrust that into the – you're going to have more drag, not necessarily increased wear. So when you look at a B50 rating on an engine, and I know this has kind of went out of style, the B50 ratings, if you have an engine that's been in the marketplace for a long time, the B50 is generally pretty accurate. Like PACCAR came out when it was brand new, and they said, we have a B10 rating, and 90% of our engines are going to go over a million miles before they're – it was brand new. They had no history. I think they just took a number and threw it out there because it looked good. But
yeah.
The D13 – the X15 and the ISX, the DD15, they all have reliable B50 ratings. And when you look at them and you look at the D13, it has a 1.2 million mile B50 rating. The DD15 has a 1.2 million mile B50 rating. The X15, I've heard it was either 850 or it was a million mile. It's not quite as high. And in my opinion, well, and there's a couple reasons for this. One of them is I think that side loading of the piston, over time, it's not unusual wear. It's nothing that they have a huge issue with, but it is increased drag, and over a million miles, you will have somewhat increased wear because of that thrust loading. There's just no way around that. That's why he doesn't see anything, and I wouldn't expect him to see anything. I mean, it's not like the guys at Cummins don't know how to build an engine. They just build an engine designed to do different things, and that's kind of what we're talking about here. We're achieving different goals, and here's what the differences are. I'm not saying one is right or wrong. I'm just saying here are some of the differences. So back in the day, before we had the correct transmissions and before we had the downsped gearing, you know, everybody kind of had the same philosophy going on. Let's have a longer stroke. We'll put a little bit shorter rod in there because that does help. And here's where this really helps and why I understand Bruce loves to watch the boost gauge. So on an engine with a long stroke and a short rod, you have more variation in piston speed. It is slower coming up the top dead center, and it's faster to bottom dead center because of the relative and actual length of that lean on the rod. So when that piston is accelerating fast away from top dead center down to bottom, it has a lot of suction, and it's pulling in a lot of air, and it gets a really good mix going on. Those engines don't require as much boost at low RPM because they rely on that acceleration away from top dead center. That makes sense?
It does. It
so
does.
When, yep. If you take a syringe, and you pull it really fast, you know, you get a lot of suction. And if you pull it slow, you don't get that much suction. So a Volvo with a longer rod has a more consistent piston speed, and it has slower acceleration away from top dead center. So it requires more boost to get that cylinder full. Does that make sense?
It does. And what helped was, and I didn't even get enough time to go through them as much as I wanted to, but just watching a couple of those videos, once you can picture a couple of these things, then it starts to make more sense when you're introduced to another idea like this.
Sure. Sure. So here is a reason why one engine, Bruce is 100% right, you would want to see 1 or 2 pounds of boost running down the road, while on another engine, you'll need 8 or 9 pounds because of the rod difference. The rod, the speed away from top dead center is not there, so that engine needs to make a little more boost. Now, advantage of the longer rod, shorter stroke is we have more dwell time at top dead center and at bottom dead center. And when we have more dwell time, dwell can help increase torque because the piston stays up at top dead center longer, the explosion happens, and more force is created because it has more time to fully develop that combustion event before it pushes the piston down.
That makes sense.
Does that,
too.
That make that, oh, okay. Yep. So this is the, here's where we're starting to see the differences in the design philosophy. Neither one's right or wrong. They're
right.
just different, and each one has an advantage and a disadvantage. So when we look at when we know that a lot of the friction is created in the engine is in the piston, 40% of that, it's oh, Jesus. One of these days I'm going to calculate the actual amount of horsepower it takes to overcome friction. It's something in the neighborhood of 28 to 33 horsepower it takes just to overcome friction, depending on the displacement of the engine. The bigger the engine, the more horsepower it takes to overcome friction.
Let me give you a kind of a funny comparison that just popped into my head because I've been out at the homestead all week, hiding out by myself, trying to get work done. And when I bought this place, it came with an old 1971 Ford tractor, little mm-hmm. diesel tractor, but a decent size mm-hmm. Tractor, you know, something you could mm-hmm. pull plows around with and farm with. And I knew nothing about those things. And I opened it up. It's got this nice little simple diesel. No idea what kind. It's 26 horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
It's a
mm-hmm.
pretty decent sized tractor. And I can do some pretty crazy stuff with it with 26 horsepower. You're talking about the fact that we need more horsepower than that possibly just to overcome the drag on the piston.
Yes. Yes, exactly. That's how I like to look at it. I'm thinking it's like a lawnmower, you know what I mean? It's much horsepower, and we know how much fuel it takes if you have a riding lawnmower to drive around. It's significant. It's
yeah.
And all the engineers agree on this. So let's take the traditional rod and stroke arrangement. And so we'll look at the Cummins ISX and X15. It has a 6.65-inch stroke. So at 1,350 RPM, that piston is moving 1,496 feet per minute. Okay?
Okay.
At 1,100 RPM, it's moving 1,219 feet per minute. So you can start to see how we're going to have a reduction in friction and what that's going to, how it's going to impact fuel efficiency based on the horsepowers we're talking about right now. So if I go down, and I've done it for the Cat and the Detroit, but we'll just keep this quick here. So if we go down to the Volvo, it's got a 6.22-inch stroke. And at that same 1,350 RPM, it's 1,399 feet per minute. And when you get to looking at that, you're like, well, it's not that much difference. And
right.
this is why if we gear a Volvo to run at 1,350 RPM, it's not really going to be anything special.
Yeah,
but
right.
when we leverage the ability of the Volvo to run at lower RPM, that number goes to 984 feet per minute at 950 RPM. It's a 34% reduction in piston speed versus
wow.
what the Cummins is running at 1,350. And a lot of folks run at 1,350, right?
Oh, yeah. If I had to pick an average RPM that most people spend their time at, it's right around there.
Right. And 1,100 is kind of the basement for the X15. And I think Bruce would kind of, you might get down to 1,050 with it, but most people running that X15 are comfortable at around 1,100. And so it's 1,219 feet per minute versus 984. So it doesn't look like a lot up front until you start to build in the scenarios that happen out in the real world and understand how to leverage the advantage. So
right.
you have a significant reduction in piston speed. We also have a significant increase in dwell time because the piston isn't moving as fast. We have a lot more dwell time at top dead center and bottom center. Also think about the piston mass. Now we talked about a big bore piston is obviously bigger. And when you have the rod arrangement the Cummins has on it, they have to account for that thrust load. So they put a bigger skirt on it, and they put special coatings on it, anything they can do to reduce the wear, but you still have drag there. You also have that inertia or G-force slamming the crankshaft every time. So if you have a bigger piston, you know, coming down at that high rate of speed and slamming that crankshaft, you have more chance for vibration And this is one of the reasons why it's kind of difficult to start to really downspeed a Cummins, because the piston weighs more and you're putting more thrust load on the liner. Now, them aren't the only reasons, but they are contributing factors.
Well, let me jump in here for two reasons. One, Henry's here, and we're going to bring him in a second, so because he may have comments on this as well. The other thing, when it comes to what you were just talking about, Bruce absolutely gets this, because when they first started building high-performance engines, which was their thing for a long, long time, I mean, the people that went to Bruce's shop for years and decades were after one thing, horsepower and performance. It was kind of when I got together with Bruce that we really started learning from each other, which is wonderful, and now we're doing it again. And we had all these same disagreements because his focus was just performance. That's what he did. That's what he was known for. Mine was just fuel mileage. But what a great thing when we got together and we started learning from each other. But I can remember talking to him where they were doubling up crankshaft dampers to be able to compensate for this.
Sure, sure, absolutely. 100%. I would agree. That would become an issue. And when you have that type of vibration, even though you have the dampers on there, it will dampen it out. But you're still going to have an efficiency penalty. You're going to get good horsepower and performance, but it's going to cost you. That there's no doubt about it. So, you know, that's one aspect of just the stroke, some of the things that we have to consider. So one of the other things that becomes very important in a downsped engine, it's your main journals. And when you look at the main journal size on an X15, it's 5 inches. It's big. It's got big main journals in it. The D13 is only 4 1/4. And, you know, a lot of people be giggling, well, that's little bitty main journals. And they are smaller, but they're smaller for a reason.
Right.
And what the guys at Volvo had
figured out
was...
And that reason was not because the accountants wanted to save money. Sometimes that's the reason things happen on these things, but that's not the case here.
No, and this is kind of where the departure is on the rotating assembly and what differentiates a downsped engine from a traditional engine. Traditional engine uses the bigger main bearing journal. When you have a smaller main bearing journal, it requires less oil pressure and volume to keep that journal lubricated. And I know you know where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
So that 5-inch journal at an engine oil pump is mechanically driven, and it depends upon the engine RPM to create pressure and volume, right?
Right.
So when we run it at really low RPM, what happens? The oil pressure and the volume fall off, correct?
Yep. That makes
sense. And if you have a big diameter journal, what's going to happen? It's going to starve for oil.
Yep.
And what's going to happen when it starts for oil? So this is exactly why they went to the smaller diameter.
In my world, what happens when that occurs, I start getting oil samples with lead and copper.
No, you're exactly right. No, you're exactly right. So the 5-inch journal works great on a traditionally geared engine that's going to spend time above 1,100 RPM. But once you drop that below 1,100 RPM or 1050, and wherever Bruce says he's comfortable running that, it's not going to go down as low as the Volvo because of the differences in the diameter of that main journal. It requires less oil pressure, less volume to lubricate that smaller journal. Now, everybody's going to say, yeah, but it's not as strong. When we go over to the rod side, this is where it gets a little unique. The D13 actually has the biggest rod journal of the bunch. It's 3.898 inches. The X15 is 3.70. So the X15 has a very, very big diameter main, and it has a very big rod. It's got a beefy crankshaft. There's no doubt about it. But it's not designed to run at very low RPM because you'll end up starving the damn thing for oil. The D13 took that 3.898-inch rod journal, so they had plenty of overlap between the main and the rod, and that increased the strength. That put the strength back into the crankshaft still be able to use the smaller diameter on the main.
So this is the explanation of the term journal overlap.
This is journal overlap right here, yes. And I'm sure this is probably supposed to be expressed in a percentage too. I'll find out the correct expression that we're supposed to use on that. But the D13 in the industry has been widely recognized as having the most journal overlap in the industry, and that's how they build the strength back into the crankshaft and allow it to operate at low speed as well. So
got it.
This is why the Volvo can run at low speed, and then we have lower average piston speeds because we have longer rods. We rely on dwell time, boost, and injection duration to make torque, where the Cummins relies more on stroke. Make sense?
It does. And Henry's here. Henry, good morning. I thought
good morning.
Henry was here. Oh, there he is.
Howdy, howdy.
I have my phone on mute because I'm in my Jeep.
Got it.
Gotcha.
What, do you have a cherry bomb or a thrush muffler on that thing or something? Why is it so loud?
No, just wind noises high on a Jeep.
Ah, got it. Yeah, that makes sense. Kind of like all the Freightliners I ever owned. Sorry.
Not in the Cascadia.
Henry,
now,
just
that
smack
is
him.
True. That is true. I will say that I never owned one, but I actually got to drive one of the first prototypes before they had even ever released it. And that was the first thing I noticed and the first thing I commented on. I said, "You finally got it quiet in here. Thank you."
I would agree with you. They done a nice job with that. Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's funny when Joel talks about all this downspeeding, and I think back to when I first started my career working at Weaver's Chicken, and at that point in time, they were already downspeeding from where they were, where most trucks were running gear-bound up against 2100,
mm-hmm.
and they were talking about the lower RPMs back then. This is back in 83, because mm-hmm. they were running a lot lower than they were prior to that. Of course, it's gone farther.
Mm-hmm.
I said if we keep going down bit after bit, we won't need a tack. You'll be able to count the pistons going up and down, kind of like an old two-cylinder John Deere.
Yeah, we're well below half. I can remember when 2300 was common.
Yeah, with the two-stroke
right.
Detroit. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I guess the take home on all this, and I know it's probably getting confusing for a lot of people, but hopefully we have a little bit better understanding why some engines you really want to run down there when you're cruising along on the flat at no boost, and other engines will that rod length has a lot to do with that, the acceleration away from top dead center. Why some engines can run all day at low RPM and why some can't. It has to do with the diameter of the main journals on the crankshaft and how we can supply lubrication to them. And again, I am not saying one is right or one is wrong. All I'm saying is this is how I do it and this is how I'm leveraging it to my advantage and these are my results. I'm sure that Henry goes through this type of stuff all the time on his, and he's looking for little advantages here and there that he can leverage when he's on the road. I'm sure that a Cummins engine has advantages. I know they do Miller cycles, and they hold valves open to increase the expansion versus the compression ratio. They do a lot of clever things on that side, too. I don't run a Cummins, so I'm not as well versed on what's happening there. I'm sure that they have some unique things that they leverage to increase their fuel mileage. There's guys out there running a Cummins that they get good fuel mileage. There's no doubt. You're going to get a Volvo perspective from me. You're going to get the Detroit perspective from Henry, and you will get the Cummins perspective from Pittsburgh Power. So we kind of got it covered here.
Yeah.
I know I take a lot of heat because all I talk about is Volvo. Well, that's what I run. You know,
but
that's what I'm here for, I think.
And just so everybody knows, not only is it what you've run them for a lot of years. You have a very, very strong, close relationship with Volvo and their engineers, and they've opened up all kinds of resources for you, and you go over to Sweden. Why would you talk about anything else?
Right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I just don't have the knowledge and the understanding, quite frankly. I get how the engine, the basics work, but I could never take a Cummins for a person and tweak it to get the maximum fuel efficiency out of it. I wouldn't even attempt to do it. I would say go see Bruce.
Well,
you know, that's where you need to go.
You know, I used to just try to learn everything about fuel mileage I could possibly learn. Aerodynamics, mechanical drag, engine performance when I really didn't understand all these architecture issues. But I knew they're the things that we could improve. The big ones, air in and air out. If you can get good airflow into a diesel, good airflow out of a diesel without resistance, there. And then I did start learning about tuning, how we can optimize some things like that. But I was still missing a big part of the engine. And at some point, and it's why you guys are here now, and it's why I have Mike Beckett, at some point, one human can only learn so much, and it's not brain power, it's just time. I mean, if you decided to go learn all of this about the Cummins engine, well, then you wouldn't be learning about the Volvo. If I spend more time learning about mechanical drag and oil viscosities, then that's not as much time I get to spend on rolling resistance or alignment issues and wheel bearing adjustment with Mike. And at some point, this becomes so crazy complicated, and there's huge volumes of information, there's just never enough time. And even in the bigger picture, no matter – let's just take the stuff Mike Beckett knows about alignments.
Mm-hmm.
He's been doing it for like, I don't know, like 102 years or something. No matter how hard I work, I can never, ever gain the knowledge he has. I just can't.
No.
And that's just one area. So this is why this is how I've started to structure my shows and everything we do. I can kind of be the guy that kind of knows enough about all of this that with your help, I'm now understanding engine architecture. With Henry's help, I'm learning more about aerodynamics. I'll never have either one of your base of knowledge, but it works really well when we all work together. This group and what we're doing on fuel mileage, you would probably agree. I think the Volvo engineers would be pretty impressed themselves with all of this, right?
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt.
They
look at what's going on here, and quite frankly, when you get into the OEM level, everything gets so compartmentalized, just like you're talking about. No one person can know everything. What most of the OEMs lack nowadays is exactly that person that has that overview or that high-level overview of everything that's going on and can put all the pieces together. They've got extremely skilled people in each one of the cubicles inside the engineering complex, and they each know their individual part better than anybody could know it. But when you put those parts together, they all look at each other and go, "Now what?"
Right. Right.
This is the service that you, me, Henry are providing back to the engineering staff is, okay, how does this work in the real world?
Yeah. Yeah. And I will say I am a big believer in understanding what your particular skills are and using those to my advantage. And the line that I stole from Larry Winget that really sums this up is discover your uniqueness and exploit it in the service of others. One of my uniquenesses, that 30,000-foot view of what's happening in a really complex situation, I have it's easy for me to grasp all of that. I'm not as good down to that really minute detail level. I have to be somewhat, and I used to have to be more because I had to start learning that stuff. But now I'm more free in all areas of the stuff I teach, not just fuel mileage, it's taxes, it's financial planning, it's maintenance, all kinds of things. I spend more time now talking to people like you so I get a basic understanding of this idea. But then I can look at it and absorb it all and explain the big picture to people in a way that they can understand it better. That's just a skill I have for whatever reason. And I've now learned that I should spend more time up there and only spend as much time as I need down in the details just to make sure I'm getting it right.
Correct. Yeah, no, I agree.
Absolutely. Yep. Thanks to Joel, I'm wanting to understand more on the engine architecture side. I've always spent my time on aerodynamics because, well, that was something I could change.
At that point in time,
especially on the trailer, there wasn't much done at the beginning. There was a lot to be had.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So it's exciting. And, Joel, I think today's lesson was a good one. I think, for sure, for me, it helped clear up several things and helped me start moving down that path. And I think that's a nice little chunk. You know, much more than that, and I might start fading out too. But
if we continue to do that, that'll work. A couple of little things every show. What I'll probably do after Matt's is over, because I know Alec is buried, we will probably put this information together in kind of like an infographic type of thing, and then I'll shoot it over to you, and then you can post it, share it with Bruce, whatever you want to do, hopefully the information gets out there and people really start to have a better basic understanding of what's going on.
Who's got a lot of noise in the background right now?
That's got to be Henry in the Jeep.
I was a little worried because for some reason it sounded like you ran into a bridge abutment.
Did it go away when I muted it?
Yeah, it did.
Yeah, I'm not hearing it anymore. Whatever it was, I'm not hearing it now. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay.
Where I was, there was traffic.
Hey, by the way, we have some calls. I do have another topic I want to talk about because it just happened to me yesterday, and it's really timely with what's going on with this. I'll tell the story, but it's very timely for me, and it was such an interesting story. Where was I going with this? Oh, Henry, were you listening to the show before you got to us? Usually not, because if you had time to listen to the show, you'd be on there with us.
Yeah, no, I was not.
So I'm gonna give you a real quick rundown. You're gonna get the Reader's Digest version of what I opened with this morning, and you know this really well. When you're talking to people about fuel mileage, just like all of us, you always get the people that say, well, I do heavy hauler, I do car hauling, and we can't get any fuel mileage, so why should we bother trying? And the exact opposite is true, and I got up at 3 o'clock this morning. By the way, you may have to hustle to keep up today. For some reason, both Joel and I got up at 3 o'clock this morning, over-caffeinated ourselves, and started coming up with ideas.
Well, I got up at 3:30 Central, so.
What? How goofy is that? All three of us were up at that ungodly hour of 3 o'clock this morning.
Especially when I'm actually off. I'm on a staycation right now because I'm getting ready to go out on a two-week tour.
Yeah, so I decided to try to point out to people it is the exact wrong thinking. The worse your fuel economy is, the more you should be pushing to get every tenth, even if you don't think you can measure it. If we're doing something we know affects the physics, then do it. And the numbers were incredible. And here's how I did it.
What?
I took it out
sure
to...
Sure it is.
Yeah, I took it out to... I said, if we can get somebody at 4.5 miles to the gallon up to 5.5, I'll calculate the savings per year, and then I'm going to go another step further. I'm going to start showing you, if we took those savings and invested them in the S&P 500, what happens all the way up to a 30-year career. And then I took an example that would be you and Joel. Well, what if you're at 10 and a half and we're trying to get to 11 and a half? You both gained a mile per gallon. In most people's mind, the result is the same, but it's not even close. Here's the, I'm not going to go through all the numbers I went through this morning, but here's the quick results. When you get to from 4.5 to 5.5, annual savings are almost $18,000 at 110,000 miles a year and today's fuel price. Almost $18,000 to get one more mile per gallon. The savings for you guys to do the exact same thing is only $3,600 instead of $18,000. And I went one step further. You guys would have to work 10 times harder to get that one more mile per gallon than the guy at 4.5.
That does not come easy when you get up to these higher numbers, and you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Now let's jump to the big number. If we took the savings and invested it in the S&P 500 that has a lifetime return of 9.81%, I use the exact number. I challenge anybody to call me on any of these numbers and tell me how anything is wrong or even optimistic. None of these numbers are optimistic. These are absolutely real. At 4.5, you get to 5.5, you take all the savings, you put it in the S&P 500, and you let it sit there. You don't have to add any other money. All we're adding is the money we just saved you. In a 30-year career, you would have $2.8 million in your retirement account. Now,
absolutely.
For you guys, I have bad news. If you work really hard to get that one more mile per gallon and you invest all the savings, you only end up with $581,000. It's chump change.
Although I will take $581,000.
Really? All right. I guess.
Well, it'd be, you know, $581,000 still real money.
All right. We have a bunch of calls, but I'm going to tell a shortened version
Kevin,
of the story.
Before you get farther on that, and I'll never forget, I was going through Houston, and he's retired now, but the person that used to be vice president of marketing at Daimler, he called me up in the boardroom at Detroit, and I guess they were getting ready to put a commercial together or an advertisement, and he said, Henry, what does a tenth of a mile of the gallon mean to you? I said, well, it depends which tenth it is. And they're like, what do you mean? A tenth's a tenth. I said, no. I said, if I pick up a tenth and I'm at 5 miles of the gallon, that's a pretty big deal. If I pick up a tenth at 10 miles of the gallon, it's not really that big of a deal.
We almost can't measure it at that point. I don't mean measuring the tenth, but the savings is hardly worth talking about, really. And I'm the guy that, you know, we're dealing in pennies and millimeters, but at some point you have to look at how much effort and money you have to put into getting that one-tenth.
Exactly. The better you do, the less it helps you.
Yeah, and Joel said this earlier. The four of us on the show are all slightly retarded about this because we don't even look at the money it costs anymore. Well, I always do, but you know, we're the ones out there just trying to prove we can find a way to get one more tenth. And I'll relate it back to that super truck. I ended up creating a macro for a response, so all I had to do was hit a key and not keep typing it again, because everybody was, those fairings are going to get torn off in the first 15 minutes. You can't use that in my operation. That's not practical. That thing's never going to be able to. So my response was, it's not meant to be practical. It's not meant to ever be a production truck. It's a concept truck.
Well, yeah. It's seeing how far you can push it. And the other thing, too, is how they test the super truck, what they got to go through. And, Joe, I'm sure you've heard it before. They're like, well, their mileage isn't that much better than what yours is. Yeah, but my duty cycle is nothing like they put that through for Super Truck. Nothing at all like it.
You're not wrong for sure.
All right, so here's my story, and I would have saved this for another time, but it's really timely right now. I have a group coaching program that I started a couple months ago, and I am having so much fun with this. I look forward to my group coaching call because what I tell people, I do two really. We alternate weeks. I do one just business, money, trucking, and I do another one about health. And both of them are a lot of fun, but I'm really having fun with the trucking stuff. People are bringing me some and I will do all kinds of work in the background. You send me, tax returns, financial reports, I'll dig into them. When we get together for the call, I'll go over everything with you. And I think I have found a way that it makes it worth it for me to spend the time doing this. I'm getting enough value out of it. And the recipients are getting incredible amounts of value because I'm only charging $72 a month to be in the program, and I will do a lot of work in the background. But I'm having a lot of fun with it. So I think I told you, I think I've mentioned that family fleet. We may have talked about it last week. That just got almost decimated. I mean, they were probably 2 months away from going out of business. So I started working with them, and their huge problem, and it wasn't just them. It was the whole segment that they're in. Drivers just disappeared. Like $90,000 was not attracting drivers who are home every night. I was shocked by that. I still can't fathom why, but I verified it. It wasn't just them. I went and checked with a couple other fleets in that segment. They all experienced the same thing. It's really kind of odd. So I said, well, we've got to work on some things. And I said, let's start with fuel mileage. And immediately the response is, no, we can't scare off the drivers. And I said, no, I have an idea. And I've used it before, and I want to use it again. So I've explained the fuel bonus program that I developed. And Joel, you said you and your brother had something really similar. And that makes sense. So he went from running ads and getting zero phone calls. Today, he is doing four driver interviews, and he's doing it because he implemented the program, and his drivers are so happy with it that they're telling all their friends.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
But then he hits me with this. In our coaching call yesterday, he said, don't freak out on me because we're still struggling. I mean, cash flow is a little tough right now where we're trying to dig out of that hole, and you got to be careful when you're digging out of that hole. You can slip back in pretty easy. So I'm trying to explain that to him, and he said, don't freak out on me. I know what you're going to say, but I want you to hear this and just help me think through it. And I said, all right, that's fair. He said, I have an opportunity to buy a trucking company. And he said, it's $2.8 million. Don't freak out. And I said, I'm starting to freak out. And because if you come to me with most trucking companies that want $2.8 million in their, kind of typical operations, I'm not going to be very excited about this.
Nope.
And he said, don't freak out. Here's why. I think you will be able to answer a lot of my questions. He said, but you might find this interesting. He said, it's a FedEx contract. And I said, oh, yeah. I said, we can talk about that pretty quick because I'll have most of these answers right off the top of my head. I know these numbers inside and out. I know every issue you've got to look at before you buy the contract. I've sold a contract. I've helped other people buy contracts. This is a big deal now. There are our business brokers who specialize in FedEx contracts. And there is a broker in this deal. Damn brokers. Every time I use that word, these guys are just scumbags, I'll tell you. I'm kidding, obviously. But it has thrown a complication in here. And here's what it is. They gave me enough knowledge that I am really interested in this. Really interested. But if I want the data I really need, We have to pay $3,000 to get it. That's the broker.
Mm.
So here's kind of the big picture. And like I said, I'm really excited about this because, one, I think this is a really good deal based on what I've heard so far, really good opportunity. So $2.8 million is the sale price. According to them, and I have not had been able to verify this with tax returns or business reports, that's what I'm going to have to pay for, there is about $780,000 of cash flow. Pretty healthy number.
Okay.
And the ratio, that is less than 4x net earnings. That's a good price on a business, especially a business like this, that if I can get in there and what I want from them, this is the other thing I want and I have to pay for, every FedEx terminal maintains a master truck list that shows the truck's points, and they change all the time. So when a new run comes up for bid, they recalculate everybody's points and they put out the master truck list, and it shows what, if the truck has a dedicated run right now, what it is and what its points are. And your points are how you bid on the dedicated run that's up. And you can give up a dedicated run to get a better dedicated run with your points. Then that run goes up on the board. We used to have all day meetings when this would happen. They'd put four or five new runs up on the board, and it was like an eight-hour auction. And I had spreadsheets and calculators, and I was in there, you know, I knew every number and why I wanted this run. I used to love this stuff. So if I could get that master list, here's why this could be such a good deal. If I buy anybody's – and this is like a 20 to 30 truck fleet, I think – again, I don't have enough details. And I don't have anything in writing, so I'm trying to remember everything from the conversation yesterday. If we take an average 20 to 30 truck fleet, I don't know if I'd be willing to pay 4x net earnings because there's a lot of risk. In a general fleet where you're out there selling to a customer, you can lose accounts overnight.
You don't own those accounts. I would never, ever even consider that because, you buy something and there's even just a personality conflict with somebody in the shipping and receiving office of the customer you just bought, you're out on your ass. I mean, there's no way. Yeah.
That's why FedEx contracts are so valuable.
Are valuable.
Because I could go in there and once I get that truck list, this contract might be like mine. And mine, I said, my contract is recession-proof. And here's why. We had a lane, Orlando to Richmond Hill, Georgia. It was our best single-run lane. We're one driver, and he's out and back every day. He's home all the time. He doesn't work weekends. Those are great runs, especially for profit, and they're easy to handle. You never have driver turnover if you just take care of your drivers. So we had seven of those every day. Five were dedicated. Mm. Two were on the extra board. Most days, all seven would run. You get a slow month like January or July. I've been in that seventh slot at one time. And in January and July, my truck never moved off the fence the entire month. So then six... in those two slow months, six might run two or three times a week. Five was pretty rock solid. Four never missed a day. And my three runs were one, two, and three.
Hmm.
FedEx would have to shut down completely before my trucks wouldn't have run. And it's not a deal where if I sell the contract, like you said, a customer, all they have to do is just not like the way the guy looks when he walks through the door, the new owner, and you're out on your ass. Mm-hmm. That can't happen at FedEx. You sell the contract to them, and that person steps into your shoes, and all of your seniority, all of your points, everything goes with it, and FedEx FedEx never gets rid of contractors unless you are a total dirtbag. And it would take a while. You'd have to screw up a lot of things before anything would happen. So That's why these things sell for such a good price, and they sell pretty quick. I had a little bidding war when I sold mine. So if I could look at this, I started to get excited for the guy. I'm like, look, I'm going to look at these numbers for you, and if it's as solid as it could be – oh, here's another one. I immediately saw a huge opportunity to probably take that $780,000 of free cash flow and make it about $1 million within the first year. And we're not talking about fuel mileage. All we are talking about – fuel mileage would play a little part of it, but if I really – dug into each truck, saw their fuel mileage, we might be talking about 1.2 or 1.3 if I started working on that. But here's what he was doing. The trucks were on a full-service lease.
Oh.
So the $2.8 million gets you zero assets. But you know how horrible those damn lease trucks are.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. That's probably to your advantage because most people screw the specs up anyway, and it would be a huge opportunity to go in there with cash flow, a guaranteed customer, and then set the trucks up right for what they're – that would be a fun one. That would definitely be a fun one to do.
Doesn't this sound exciting? We go in – Well, first off – every single thing about a full-service lease, everything is more expensive than you can just do it on your own. And I completely understand why private fleets use full-service leasing. I can never understand why trucking companies do. You are a trucking company. The thing you do to provide value people, to your customers – is you know how, or you should know how to buy, spec, and maintain trucks. That is your profit center. That's what you do. Why would
give
that profit to somebody else?
Because you just simply lack knowledge. I've seen this time and time and time again. Guys do this because they don't want to spend the time and money investing in techs for their shop. They don't want to put up the building and maintain the shop. They don't want to maintain the grounds. You know, there's some money involved there for sure, but it mostly goes to what you're talking about. With today's trucks, there's virtually nobody that can really sit down with confidence and spec out a truck and say, it's going to work in this duty cycle and have a high degree of confidence it's going to work. So everybody's just really timid and gun-shy nowadays, and the technology's changing so quick, it's hard for them to keep up. So they just say, you know what, this is too much for me. I'm going to let the dealer take care of it all. Just do a full – I have seen company after company after company do this.
Now, Joel, Henry, put your numbers hat on because I have a feeling you're going to be able to understand this pretty quickly, what the potential is here. I know exactly what these full-service lease trucks are. They're just average specs. Nothing, no thought put into it whatsoever, and they're twin screws. So I'm going to come in and spec new Volvo 4x2s, and what kind of potential fuel savings are we going to have?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're going to – it's going to be in the neighborhood of probably 10-12%, most likely.
When I look at the FedEx trucks and the UPS trucks and whatnot with their twin screws and stuff pulling doubles, I'm like, my gosh, there's so much money left on that table.
That's what I mean. And now we multiply that by 20 or more. And, Joel, how much less can we maintain that truck for than what they're paying them to maintain it?
There's no
doubt.
Because,
again, we know their maintenance costs not only are higher than ours dollar for dollar, but they have to make a profit on that maintenance. And our maintenance costs are going to be better because of what you talk about all the time. All these things we do to improve that fuel economy are going to lower those maintenance costs.
Sure. Absolutely.
I got
Absolutely.
So excited about this. I was like,
The great thing about FedEx, Kevin, and I know you know this, you know what their average dispatch speed is, right?
Absolutely.
So there's no need to run 75 mile an hour everywhere you go.
No.
When you're being dispatched at an average speed of 47.5 mile an hour, right?
Yep, I ran 57 my entire career at FedEx and never was even close to being late for anything.
Yes, I've run a lot of FedEx stuff through Schneider, and they have the same requirements as what the contractors do on dispatch speed.
Yep,
we do the same thing. We can run it at 57 and make our deliveries with no problem at all.
And, not even close.
So, no, that is a hell of a great opportunity right there. There's no doubt about it. Especially
now, you want the bad news?
You don't get saddled with the junk trucks. What's the bad
news? You want the bad news?
Mm-hmm.
Because after I got so excited and dug into this, and I actually was already contemplating I might spend the $3,000 to get this information. Because I really don't want this guy to spend $3,000 right now.
Right.
So I'm thinking, hell, I might call this broker and pay the money so I can get the rest of the data because I want to see this. And then I got really stupid for a little while and started thinking I was going to buy this. I don't know what the hell I was thinking, but it sounds like so much fun. But here's the thing. And if anybody wonders why I am so anti-government and I'm so fed up with the government we're dealing with, the thought that popped into my head, and I'm serious enough about this that I am pretty sure I'm going to tell my you know, the guy I'm helping with this, I can't recommend you do this. And there's only one reason. It has nothing to do with the contract, the numbers. It's the Department of Labor ruling right now because I'm afraid you could spend $2.8 million and be put out of business overnight.
Yeah. No, I hear you.
Now, I hope the odds are for that aren't high, but the problem is the government has – I was about to drop an F-bomb. The government has screwed this up so bad that nobody knows. The attorneys I talk to don't know. There is a group of attorneys out there on this that are saying, based on how this ruling is worded, if the government chose to, they could go after franchises with this.
I've heard that.
Well, if that seems so extreme to me, but if they could, then clearly a FedEx contract is right smack in the bullseye.
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. They love picking on the trucking companies over this. There's no doubt about that.
Well, when you say about that with the franchises and all that, I'm like, yeah, everything from McDonald's to Kentucky Fried Chicken to
So, you know, Joel, Henry, think about this, and I'm sure it's why we get excited. You probably already thought about this. Here's an opportunity to buy a trucking company, not have to deal with all of the bullshit you have to deal with in a traditional trucking company, drivers and customers and compliance and all that bullshit. I'm going to buy a trucking company where I get to spend all my time doing exactly what I want to do, making it more efficient and profitable.
Yep. I hear you. It would be a fun thing for sure.
If I didn't,
especially if you were doing it with a Freightliner. I mean, I know you were talking Volvo, but you know.
wait a minute! I could have even more fun. I'm going to split the fleet in
50-50.
Just for the fun of it, I'm going to do Volvo, Freightliner, PACCAR, and International. And so I can run comparisons all the time.
There you go. Nice.
That'd be a blast. If I didn't love what I was doing so much, and if I wasn't so committed to where we are as a company right now, not only would I buy this one, I would have two or three business brokers that specialize in these things sending me every new contract that went up for sale, and I'd look at to start collecting them.
No, it makes sense. It definitely makes sense. There's a method to the madness for sure there.
Yeah. Oh, all right. I better settle down. should we get to some phone calls?
It might be a good idea.
We've been talking for over an hour and a half. And I had some, I'm not going to say what I want to say. I had somebody, I did this the other day. I talked for a long time at the open about my CMC. I had some seats left and I really want to fill it up. By the way, since I mentioned it, today is the last day to sign up and we are doing something kind of fun. If you are in the audience at the live CMC at Matt's, we are going to do a drawing and we're going to give away two $1,000 seats to the year program. So two people are going to get to go through the year program free, but you got to be in the audience. So there are some seats available. You have to go to the Matt's site, truckingshow.com. You'll find the CMC. It's easy to find and get signed up. And that's all I'm going to say about it today. But somebody actually called my call screener and was bitching at her, dropping F-bombs, because he was upset that I spent too much time talking to my about the CMC and I didn't go to calls. My first thought was, are you really calling and dropping F-bombs on my employee about something you didn't pay a penny for?
I love it.
Well, yeah.
There's a real simple fix. Whatever device you're listening to this show on has an off button.
that's where we live today.
Sheesh. All right. Let's get to some calls. Ron, thanks for being patient. Welcome.
Hey, I enjoyed the conversation. I'll tell you what it is. You know, I play my mandolin 5 hours every morning. Well, I did it for a year. Now I do it like today. When you guys were talking about getting up at 3, for me to do it for 5 hours, I'd have to get up at 2. But anyway, I'm way past a year.
Hey, Ron.
So anyway, yeah.
For some reason, every time you talk about it and you say the word mandolin, all that pops into my head is the Bruce Hornsby song.
Oh, Mandolin Wind, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're going to be at the CMC.
I am?
Yeah. You'll be there, right? I talk about music, and when it comes to mandolin, I talk about a guy named Lloyd Lohr who made that mandolin that everybody with a curly Q and the F holes. Okay, he designed that back in the 20s. And guys have been taking that thing apart to see what exactly it was that gives it that sound for about 50 years, maybe longer. But anyway, hey, I'll tell you all about it when I'm there.
All right.
I'm driving. Here. Okay, listen to this. You used to paint cars, right?
Yes.
So I had my vat. I bought it for the interior color. This story has everything. Building relationships. Okay. I've known this guy, I don't know, 15 years. His shop is in, his computer shop is in between where I used to park my truck and my mailbox in Las Vegas. So I'd walk by his shop all the time, and once I got a computer, anytime I had a question, I'd take it to him. So I was in there a lot, and he started telling me he plays guitar at his church. And, nobody really ever showed him anything. And so I gave him my quick explanation. And anyway, so that's how I know this guy.
All right.
So I went in there, showed him my vet, and we were talking about it. I told him I was going to have it redone, you know, the color. I told him I was going to have it green with white flame. But anyway, he goes, I know just the guy to do it. But one of my friends from church, and he told me about the guy. I went over, he told the guy, yeah, I'm sending this guy over. Anyway, so I go over there. This place is okay. I was at SEMA too, okay. So I go to SEMA every year, and like 2 years ago, everybody was doing the electric car thing. This year, everybody was doing rap. They were having contest who could wrap a Tesla the fastest.
And like, yeah,
2 hours, if I remember right, it was less than 3 hours to wrap a Tesla right there on
wow.
a carpeted floor. Yeah. So anyway,
yeah. That wraps are
could
tough.
You give, could,
wraps are
could
it's not give, it's not as easy as some people might think it is.
Well, this is how easy it is. How much do you think it would cost for me to take a brand new vet to a paint shop and say, I want this painted high gloss golden yellow?
I have no idea. I'm going to venture
thinking,
to say it's more than $10,000.
Yeah, I'm thinking it's like $25,000. It would be. If
prices have gone
that.
Way up.
Yes.
Prices have gone way
but,
up, yeah. I have
yeah.
a really cool story about painting a vet, but I'm not going to tell it today because we have way too much going on. But somebody actually trusted me to paint a Corvette when I was 17, and I was painting a lot of I was painting a lot of muscle cars because at 17
yeah,
it would
yeah,
have been 1980.
Yeah.
So I was doing things like 69 Camaros and Mustangs and Monte Carlos and Barracudas and most of them, Joel, you're from Ohio. By the time we got a 1969 to 1980, most of the body panels were about rusted off of it, right?
Absolutely.
So I spent a lot of time brazing and welding in new sheet metal because nobody wanted to pay for new panels. So it was, you know, we're going to build our panels. And I was getting pretty good at that. I was getting a good reputation for the building the panels and the paintwork. But I had never, I probably had never even touched a Corvette at that point in my life. And some guy brought me a Corvette. I'll go to the end. The guy was a freak. His wife was an even bigger freak, and the only vet that he could afford had already been painted 4 times, and that's a mess. So now I've got to strip this thing back down to fiberglass, which is a lot of work. And even though he trusts me to paint it, he didn't trust me to go buy the paint because he wanted to make sure we took it back to the original color. And I said, look, that's the easiest thing for me to do. All I have to do is get the VIN, and I'll take it to, I'll call my paint shop, and they will give me the exact original color. I said, that's much easier than somebody wants some weird color, and I got to make sure I get it right. And he said, no. He said, I've already talked to the shop. I'm going to buy the paint. I'll bring it to you. He said, here's the car. Get started on it. When will you be ready to paint? And I said, probably sometime at the end of next week. And he said, all right. So about a week later, he drops off the paint and leaves, and I said, you know, I'll call you when I get it painted, and I did all lacquer. So you would paint it, wet sand it, paint it, wet sand it, paint it, wet sand it, buff it. So I'm all ready to paint it. I open up the paint, and I hadn't looked at codes or anything. I open up the paint, and I start mixing it, and I'm like, oh, he must have changed his mind, because I had looked up the original paint code, and it was that cherry red. And I open the can, and it's racing orange. And I'm like, well, he must have changed his mind. So I start painting it. And I just finished my last coat of color, and I'm getting ready to let it sit, and I'm going to wet sand it and go on to clear. And he shows up. And I open up the garage, and I let him in, and he blows a rod. he is just going insane. Oh, my God, you painted it orange. And I said, of course I did. You brought me the paint. And he's like, he couldn't even speak. And I said, look, relax. This is not that big of a deal. Your timing is good. If you just, I'll call my paint shop and tell them to have the order ready. You just go get it, and all I have to do is keep spraying. I don't have to change anything. And I said, in reality, you'll end up with a little deeper color the more coats we put on it. He's just freaking out. And I said, look, stop screaming at me and just go get the damn paint.
Gotta love it.
I hope I don't have that problem. I don't think I will. But Kevin, the $4,500.
Wow.
And it's going to be good. I brought it in Monday, and I'm going to pick it up today. He hasn't called me yet. He opens at 9. And it's all within walking distance of my apartment.
Nice. Well, I do have to say, even though I had to put up the guy screaming at me and his wife screaming at me sometimes, at 17 years old, I finished that stripped, painted, buffed, polished, out-the-door detailed. I finished it in about 2.5 weeks. And I put a lot of work into stripping it and buffing and polishing and all that. But I made close to $2,000 in a couple weeks at 17 years old. And that was in, I said, 1980. That was a lot of money back then.
Yeah. Well, you know, these wraps are the way that we ship our paint department to China, because that's where they make them all.
Yeah.
And,
hey,
you know,
I had an estimate. I had an estimate to get my coach wrapped. It was $50,000.
Really?
Wow.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, you know, that was going to be $5,000, but since I knew Lim, he knocked $500 off, so I got it for $4,500.
Nice.
Yeah.
Hey, Ron, cool. Got to cut you loose. Looking forward to seeing you next week. We've been telling so many stories. We better get calls or somebody's going to complain. Let's go to South Carolina. Paul, welcome.
Howdy. I'm not complaining.
All right, good.
I'd
just hang up on you if you did.
I'll call the complaints department. Yeah,
that's right.
So, I'm a car hauler and I get a better rate, but I care about fuel mileage.
Good.
So I try. You know, mostly I run 62, the truck at 102 if I want to, but more often not 62, even when I'm empty. So, if you use your numbers, 110,000 miles, $4 a gallon. If I go from 5 to 6, I save 18,000. If Joel and Henry go from 10 to 11, they save 4,000. But because they went from 6.5 to 10, they save 24,000. So that matters.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. That does matter.
So, yeah, because there's plenty that 6.5 is all you'll get when you go up a hill. Well, every other hill is a downhill. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And Joel,
mm-hmm.
Are you doing anything to try to quantify the maintenance savings numbers into something we can calculate?
Yeah, we're working on it. My brother's, you know, he's working on things as he has time, and then we talk about it. I'll have something before too awful long, I think.
Good. That'd be fun, too.
Mm-hmm.
So
maybe we can turn that $2.8 million into $3.5 million.
There's no doubt there'll be some maintenance savings there. There's no doubt about that.
So yesterday, I was listening to the replay of Mark Willis' show, and he had Jim Park and some other guy. I can't think of his name now. I think he writes for Overdrive, I think.
Okay.
So they're talking about the OEMs going to a one-world platform for trucks, cars, and everything. You know, to make it cheaper overall. And then they started talking about alternative fuels and climate change and everything.
Wait a minute. A guy called in.
My
first question when I hear that about trucks, cars makes absolute sense. My first question when I think about that in the truck market, how are they going to reconcile the fact that there's lots of countries that only run cab overs and we don't run them at all.
I don't know. Maybe we're going to be driving cab overs in the future, if H Volvos.
I mean, I'd love to have some of those European cab overs as an option here, but I don't know how they can build a one-world truck right now.
Yeah, well, that's what they were talking about anyway. So then, and then climate, alternative fuels, and somebody mentioned something about climate change. Actually, the guy's name might have been Jack Roberts or something. I'm not sure now.
Jack Roberts.
Oh, that's
maybe,
right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's who it was. So a caller called in, and he disagreed about the climate change and everything. He said the climate's been changing forever, which it has. So, but then Jack Roberts said, well, you can pay scientists to make the data lean either way.
Absolutely.
And yeah, well, but the way that I interpreted Jack Roberts' opinion was you could only make a point wrongly if you said climate change was BS. And
really?
This guy called Jack Roberts. Yeah, it's like, but the people that say climate change is happening, they're the ones that are exactly correct. And the guy called him a liar, and that's where his call got terminated. So, yeah.
Well, I've said my point on, and this is a topic I will not debate anybody on. It's not worth it. I don't want to waste my time. People are set in their ways, and I just get bored with the whole thing. My point is, Jack, if that's your point, that saying it's not changing is BS, I'm with you. Of course it's changing. We can watch it change. It's changed forever. It's not going to stop changing. My point, and do humans affect it? How could we not? How could you put, you know, 8 billion people on the planet and do all the crazy stuff we do and not impact the economy? I can agree with you all the way up to that point. Where I will disagree vehemently is we're not smart enough to figure out how to fix it, and we should stop doing stupid stuff until we do figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I don't care if people go and buy an electric car, but it's not going to save the planet. That's my opinion.
Well,
I
don't believe for a second that electric vehicles are any better or worse for the environment, just different for the environment. And again, we're not smart enough to understand all the unintended consequences of moving to electric, and especially trying to do it this fast with government subsidies.
Yeah. So, right, I'll leave you with that thought. I got to go.
All right.
Okay.
Actually, we had all those calls we were rushing to get to, and I don't know if I chased everybody off or what, but I have one more call, and then we can either go back to talking, or we could quit for the day, or you could call. So we'll see what happens. Let's go to Indiana. John, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. What's
Joel
on your mind today?
Well, first I want to get a little business out of the way. I signed up for CNC through Matt's website.
Thank you.
And there was a little bit of a thing on there that said that I needed to buy VIP access for Wednesday for any educational things going on. And since yours was the only educational thing I knew about, I went ahead and signed up. At the time,
nobody
it said
told
it was
me about
an additional
that.
Well,
we
were talking to Brett Hutto on Monday, I was kind of hoping you'd bring it up.
I couldn't bring it up. Nobody ever told me that. We've had about a million meetings about this, and nobody ever mentioned that to me. How much they charge for VIP access?
Well, here's the kicker. It was $100, but then they knocked it down 50%. So I'm just wondering, did I screw something up and not?
Wait.
I'm a little ADD.
I want to make sure I'm understanding it. We are charging $100 for the CMC. Are you telling me you had to pay $150 to get in? I mean, not to get in, but you had to pay $50 more.
That's what I'm telling you.
Well, no wonder why I haven't sold 200 seats like I thought I was going to sell in a week.
Well, of course.
Thank you for bringing that to my attention. That has never been mentioned. We have pages and pages and pages of notes, and I unless it was a meeting I wasn't in, and there have been a couple, but
Well, thank you. Here's the thing. If you can double check and verify it, I mean, we can discuss this further when I get to the I get down to Matt's. So, you know, but it's something I wanted to bring up and make sure that it wasn't something that I misread.
Let me throw it out right now. I have to believe we have a lot of people who are listening right now that are coming and have registered. So please, if you didn't pay this fee or you did pay this fee, send me a text, message me on X, call us, whatever. We have phone lines open, so you can just call. It'd be easy. And even if you don't want to come on the air, just tell the call screener. And I forget who's screening today. Chelsea, maybe? She'll pass it on to me. Yeah. We'll get to the bottom of this. But that might explain. Even if they aren't doing it, and it was some sort of a mistake, if you had the mistake happen, I have to believe somebody else saw it and probably decided, that damn Kevin, he said it was $100 and it's $200, and left.
Well, I just, you know, right. I have a buddy, I'm a company driver, and I have another buddy that we are the primary adherents to your philosophy, and we swap stories and trade data and have a good time doing it, and we've been pushing our owner really hard to try to get to buy more efficient trucks, because he comes from an agricultural background where a lot of our trucks, when I started 7 years ago, were Pete's and KW's. You know, he really likes the 579. And then he decided he's going to get away from the Cummins platform, and he decided that the MX-13 was the way to go. And I know how you feel about that. So, yeah. So then we started having all kinds of sensor problems and everything. But I'll cut to the chase. I finally convinced him to get me my Volvo, which went from a 2014 ISX which I was getting about close to 7 with if I was very judicious with the throttle and pulling light loads. Otherwise, open deck with a 35,000 on it, maybe 5.5, you know, which from listening to your program, that sounds about par for the course. So I'm in the Volvo now. Well, he only listened to about half of what I told him. I told him we needed to get at least, if he can't get me a TC or a T13 TC, at least get 247 rear end. That's what I told him. Well, he bought this truck at the auction. He's really fond of buying stuff at the auction. And it's got a 279, as far as I can tell, Meritor. So right now I'm pulling down about 8 miles per gallon, pulling heavy auto. Well, I'm pulling dunnage one way and then parts back the other way. I think this load's a little heavier. I might have 25, 30 in the box, but the load I was running over to Ohio was substantially lighter than that, and I was seeing closer to 8.5. And that's driving 60 mile an hour, 270, because I was going across Ohio on I-70. Anyway. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I apologize. I was kind of half listening there. So if there was a question in there and I missed it, and the reason I was only half listening is because I am furiously texting everybody I can think of to get this figured out.
Oh, okay. Well, then I kind of shot myself in the foot.
Got another message from ACH.
I'm with you though on your specs.
Yeah, I'm running. I've got the trailer sucked up to where the front of the trailer's right over the mud flaps, the front of the mud flaps.
Mm-hmm. Like I say, it's not. I'm doing power only, so I figured that was close enough. But I mean, I've got room to get it closer. The main thing is, I know, you know, air. If it were my truck, I'd probably go flow below air tabs. And I am running the catalyst. Now I know Joel's not a huge proponent, and I just started doing that about a week ago. So
with the gearing and the VGT turbo that you're running, it may not be a bad thing. I mean, it wouldn't be something that I would tell you quit doing immediately. There's probably some benefit there because you're not geared ideally and you're running a VGT. So it's not a bad thing.
Okay. The other comment that was made, our fleet manager, I don't think his father owned the trucking company, but I don't think I'm a gearhead, and I've got a racing background, and I actually spent a year out at Jim Russell's in Sears Point, Sonoma, and working on their cars. So, I mean, I've got two brothers. One's a mechanical engineering Purdue graduate, and the other is an MEP. And so it just runs in my blood. Unfortunately, I'm too ADD to sit down and sit in class. I went back three times.
I hear
you. I went back three times, and I just wasn't my bag. But I love to drive. I love to race. If I could afford it, that's what I'd probably be doing. But I'm 65 years old, and that window, unless you're already independently wealthy, that window closes up pretty quick.
For sure.
So the bottom line is that our fleet manager the other day said that they were going to start buying, looking for Cummins X15 with, I don't know what he said, but he said, with the Endurant, I believe. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
PACCAR?
Sure.
Yeah. And I'm like, because some tech had told him that was the way to go, that they had the fewest problems with those. And I'm like, okay, but that's not going to get us to our numbers, you know, saving fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And so he bought a bunch of trucks from, one of the dealers, and they were kind of like your TNC spec. And he's already put a bunch of money into them. I mean, his philosophy is buy it cheap at the auction and then fix whatever's wrong with it. You know, get them around half a million miles and go from there. So I'm trying not to give you too much information, but and let you talk, but I just want you to know kind of where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
So far, I'm loving the Volvo. I'm loving, like I say, it's not the fastest thing up the hill, but I'm mostly on flat ground, and the torque is wonderful, and I'm happy. I just would like to do a little better on the fuel mileage, and I don't know how much I'm going to be able to convince him to spend money for flow below and tabs and the other things that might improve the mileage.
So if you've got room to close the gap up, I'd close that truck and trailer gap up as tight as you can. If you measure from you got the little black rubber piece that's on the back of the cab fairing there, to the radius of the trailer, my truck, I'm about 13 inches.
Okay.
So I close that up as tight as you can close it. And really, that's probably all you're going to be able to do because it's pretty obvious. It sounds like this is a one-off truck in the fleet. They're not really interested in, investigating much more than that. And, manage your speed and tighten the gap up. And if you're in the eights right now as it warms up, you're probably going to be in the nines this summer.
Oh, and I left out a detail. I am on Super Singles, Michelin X Grip, I think they're –
Oh, good.
Set on them.
Yep.
But I've got I've got regional tires on the front. Probably I would be better off with line haul tires, but you know,
right.
They're wanting to take
right. You don't
these.
Have...
Go ahead.
you don't have a lot of choice when it's a fleet truck. You know, you're pretty much stuck.
Yeah. I'm just doing all this as a trial run for when I buy my own truck, and that's going to be my retirement.
There you go.
Oh,
excellent.
Hey, John. Yeah.
So I've been working on this in the background. That's why I've been so quiet. I reached out to Brent. Brent said he doesn't even think that Toby charges for VIP access, which that sounds a little odd. So he's looking into it. I've got Aaron looking into it. Are you planning on doing the year-long CMC?
Yes.
If we don't get this figured out, since you already paid it, whether it was a mistake or not, I'll knock the $50 off your year program for you.
Okay, and I'll double check my receipts to make sure that somehow, you know, I didn't make a mistake on my accounting. But the bottom line is that, yeah, I'm really excited about being there. I've been contemplating buying a truck for about 3 years now and just been on the fence because of COVID and the economy and everything else. But
well, perfect timing, because I will tell you the last 3 years would have been the worst time to buy a truck and get into the business, even if you were prepared. And we are now heading into what I consider one of the best. My only real concern right now is something catastrophic happening to this economy. Other than that, and if that happens and you know, we can see what the bottom is going to be, I will still have a plan to get through the bottom, because there has to be one. No matter how bad the economy gets, the freight has to move, and somebody has to get paid enough to make it worth doing it. So my philosophy has always been, I don't care if we have another depression. Somebody's going to move the freight, and I'm going to make sure it's people I know.
Right. I had to get over here. There's doing some shoulder work over here on 24. Yep. Headed for Detroit.
All right.
I don't know if anybody's been up 75 lately, but it's a mess in Michigan. So.
I used to do that a lot. Haven't done it in a lot of years, though.
Well, they had a big bridge job there in Toledo, and they finally finished that up after several years. And now they're, once you get up into Michigan itself, then you, as soon as you cross the line, you're right back in it.
Every time I hear about that, I have a flashback. It was early in my career, probably within the first 3 years of driving, and I was on my way up there, and I think it was the first rest area in Michigan itself, if I remember. It's been a long time. It was one of those times where I wasn't planning on pulling over and getting in the sleeper, but I needed a power nap. You know, one of those ones where you either lay your head back or you lean on the steering wheel, and if I can get 15 or 20 minutes, I'm going to be fine. And I'm sure you guys have experienced this at one point in your career. I don't even remember if I chose it. It was kind of like, as I was setting the brake, my head fell back against the seat and I fell asleep. And when I woke up, the truck next to me was pulling out, but I thought the motion was me moving. I almost had a heart attack.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That'll freak you out every time.
Yeah, I thought for sure I fell asleep while I was driving because I thought the vehicle was moving. Whoa, that is a bad feeling.
Yeah, it is. It's terrible. It's about as bad. I mean, it's about as spooky as it gets.
Yeah. Hey, John, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put you back on hold. I'm going to have Chelsea get some information so that when we get this figured out, we'll reach out to you and let you know if it needs to be resolved. We will make sure we get it resolved. Let's go to Michigan. Brent, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, thanks for taking my call. I was got hooked up and had a nice conversation with Paul talking about car hauling and trying to figure out whether or not I could handle being in a chop-top sleeper situation. And Did a little experiment this week and pretty much determined for me that would be a torture device. So what I'm trying to figure out is...
Wait. I need to understand before we move on. I have no problem standing up and walking around in those things.
Yeah. Well, I'm 6'2", and I'm a big 6'2". I'm wide and tall, so... It's tougher and I just really like being able to stand up, change and stuff and all that. So for me, it's more of a lifestyle and a personal choice. So what I'm looking at is I was asking about the difference between an 8-car and a 9-car Stinger where you've got the car out on front, and talk to Paul and I get his thing is, I don't want to lose the revenue of that car hanging out on the front. Got it. But how much money or how much fuel mileage or money can you save by a better fuel mileage?
I'm going to hedge off at the pass. This isn't even debatable. It's a no-brainer. As much as we talk about fuel economy, that one car is never going to hurt your fuel economy. It will hurt your fuel economy, but nowhere near the amount of revenue you generate by having that extra vehicle.
So that extra car is always going to generate way more than it would hurt the fuel economy.
Absolutely. We don't even have to think about trying to calculate it.
Okay. All right. Because that was good. My question was it even close? Because if not, then maybe car hauling is not the segment I should even be looking at then.
Now here's another way to look at it. I'm looking at pure financial because that's what I look at first. Let's understand what these numbers mean and then use that data to make our decision. But it doesn't mean we always have to make it by the bottom line. If we did, most of the time, I would have to tell owner-operators, you should never buy a brand-new truck. Even if you have the revenue and we know we're going to get really good fuel economy with new technology, I could make the argument every time you should be buying a used truck that's under a year old with really low mileage. Okay. If it was purely financial, I could make that argument over and over and over. But it's not always. Sometimes I want to walk in and buy the truck and be the only one that ever drove it, and I'm willing to pay a little bit of a premium for that. This is the same case. I'm not saying you can't be profitable without that other car, but if we're just looking at pure bottom line, then yes, you always have to have that car up there. It will increase the bottom line. But if you look at the numbers, and if you're in the coaching program, I could help you calculate them all, and you look at it and go, well, okay, after a whole year, here's how much I give up. I can still be profitable. I can still make a lot of money, but I'm going to give up that premium, but I'm going to do it because I really want to haul cars.
Okay. Yeah, I could, that's the kind of the thing I was trying to come up with. Because if I could get to where I'm looking at a mile and a half or a mile a gallon better with a aerodynamic tractor, a full height one pulling I've even saw a setup where they were pulling they had a head rack on the tractor and then they were pulling a Stinger trailer, but it was a condo. The tractor was a condo, so it only had two cars on the head rack. It didn't extend out over the front. And with that, you could almost get 9, depending on the size of the cars, you could get 9 on, but that's only smaller cars.
We could calculate this down to no cars on the tractor and Paul or Mark or all those guys could probably help me with how many you can get on the trailer itself in a setup like that.
Sure.
That could possibly work. I start to get a little weird about this with like the 3-car wedge trailers and stuff like that. Man, you give up so much revenue to pull those things down the road. I'm not sure how that ever makes sense.
No, I see a lot of guys, the company I'm with, there's 3 or 4 guys that pull they pull three units on a Suncoast 5 car trailers. They're pulling three chassis. I don't know how the hell they're making any money. They got really nice Peterbilts, and I'm like, you're not fuel mileage, and you're not a chassis to make revenue. I don't know how the hell they're making money, really.
Hey, Joel, Henry, do you guys agree with that thought process on, you know, losing the ability to take one or two?
Well, yeah.
Probably.
You know, and on the car hauler thing, I've always thought of that as a, you know, the big trucks that haul a bunch of them are so expensive. I've often looked at it with a van if it was done simply with the, where you could haul six.
Well,
the aerodynamic,
I had
your cost up. I've often wondered if you could overcome it.
I had a couple clients that did the enclosed, really high end stuff, and that paid really, really well. I had a couple, and this goes back again to the '90s, but
right.
I'm trying to think. There was one big carrier that did a lot of this. I can't remember the name of them, but I had like four or five clients that were all leased to that company. They were all teams. They all had, it was all high end, really kind of specialty stuff. And they were killing it back then. And I have no, I don't even remember how many they were getting in those vans or what the average was.
Well, part of my theory was, if you did a van right, and if you were over in the general cars, I often wondered if you could set it up right that you could haul regular freight in between, that it wasn't so specialized that all it could do was haul cars.
Yeah, if all it could do was haul cars and you were just pulling the average stuff around from auctions and the dealers and stuff like that, I don't think you could ever make that make sense either.
Right. But if you had it where you got rid of the deadhead part of it, I often wondered if you could do that be hauling six.
That's good thinking. That might work.
What is the difference in a soft-sided box trailer, like you were talking about going to an enclosed, because that was another angle I thought of, was a soft-sided one where you can open up and you're not enclosed. It makes it a hell of a lot easier for a big guy like myself to get in and out of the cars as you're loading them. Do you lose a lot with a soft side?
Lose a lot as far as what?
Fuel mileage.
You will,
but again,
you lose a lot with a Conestoga. I know people that are in flatbed that go to Conestoga, and it makes you 106, 108 inches wide on the trailer, and it's as they put it, it's like pulling a parachute.
Yeah, there's a lot of resistance on them.
Okay. So it's not like you're going to get,
again,
you're not going to get seven, because if you can pull six cars and get 7.5 to 8 mile a gallon, well, now does the math start working at that point? I don't know.
Well, when
you say the soft side compared to a car carrier, it'd be super aerodynamic. When I was comparing it to a regular dry van, it's not.
Well, and this is where on this show we have to speak in generalities. I don't have time to get down to the details of, but if you had this contract with this revenue and we could get this, we could go on and on. It's exactly why I have the coaching program. That's the kind of stuff we could explore in the coaching program. We could take each one of these possible configurations and start running those calculations with real world numbers, not just the three of us speaking in generalities.
Right. Kevin, one of the most unique things I ever saw was somebody that was a car hauler was they had picked up a different haul, and you don't see it that often, but they were hauling like medium-duty John Deere tractors on a car carrier.
Yeah, there's all kinds of crazy stuff that goes on.
And you just don't see that often. And my gosh, they'd be easy to load on one compared to a car, right?
You would think.
Anything?
No cab, no nothing. Just step out of the seat.
Well, some of the new car haulers are getting very low. There's a couple of new designs that when you bring the top rack down, they're not much higher than some of the smaller wedge trailers. So if you wanted to pick up, you know, a couple of tractors or something like that, that was one of the things I was thinking about, is coming up with different ways to build relationships with different places where I could pick up other, you know, other types of equipment for just the short return. Even if we're talking about just paying my fuel to return back would be a huge benefit.
Yeah.
Well, no, the person I saw doing this was double-decking tractors on a car carrier.
Brent, then you would be one of those guys that's out there just driving rates down, you scumbag.
Yeah. I'll wear it as a badge of honor.
There you go. All right. Hey, I got to cut you loose. I just looked, and for some reason, everybody wants to talk to us now. Let's go to Missouri. Wayne, welcome to the program.
How are we doing today, Kevin?
Good. What's on your mind?
I got a quick question to ask Henry, but first, on that FedEx deal, I just recently talked to a FedEx Brown person that had a contract, and he said that FedEx is merging the ground with a division, and he wasn't looking forward to it. I don't know what he meant by that. That would be something you would have to look in on that FedEx thing.
Well, I follow FedEx pretty closely, so they are finally doing that. It had been talked about for the whole time I was at FedEx, and we went through so many different. Now, the history of FedEx Ground, which is exactly what we're talking about, it's all ground that I don't reference any other division of FedEx except once in a while Custom Critical, if that's even FedEx still anymore. I'm not even sure about that. So it is ground. Ground has always been 100% independent contractors, and FedEx corporate or FedEx overnight has always been 100% employees for the most part. And there was always talk, and it was a concern of mine. I always had the kind of a, well, what if they decide to merge them and then go to all employees? You know, there's always that risk. I don't think they would. They're very successful with the independent contractor model. So that wasn't enough risk to make me worry about it. But the government does worry me. You know, anytime somebody says something like that, they're worried. Well, what they're worried about is the unknown. There's nothing for us to say. We're worried about this, and this is going to happen. Because when these things happen, nobody knows what's going to happen. And the company is usually very tight-lipped about it. They don't want people panicking. Then they just let the rumors fly, and then you're not going to know how this is going to work out until it actually works out.
Yeah. Okay, now to Henry. Henry, I just recently got a DD, switched out of a 5700 into a 49X with a DD6.
Wayne, real quick, yeah. I hate to interrupt you, but this is kind of timely information, and I want to make sure we get this out. We have solved the $100 VIP charge, and I have good news. Here's the answer from Toby. The driver must have used a VIP code from a company. And Toby said that it will show a cost, but once you get to the end and pay it, it will be credited back. And if somehow there was a glitch, Matt's themselves will get it fixed. And if for some reason they don't, we will. But I have a feeling, and he even said he's going to have to go back and look at his accounting. And when he said that, I kind of thought, oh, please don't tell me you had me check this if it really wasn't. But that would explain both ways. And then I have one other thing to say. There's only one seat left. So I'm sure that seat's going to get sold before the end of the day. So if you're interested in it, you better go do it right now. And I'm happy we hit our goal. So go ahead.
Okay. And I went from the 5700. It was a 2016. It wasn't for what I was using it for, so I went with the 49X and with the DD16. what kind of RPM should I be running this on when I'm doing my over-the-road stuff to get the best fuel mileage out of the CD16?
First of all, how's it geared?
It's an 18-speed with Kevin's worst gear ratio, 336s. Due to I do 25% of the time I'm pulling a four-axle belly dump.
The one thing, and I don't have a lot of experience in the 16, but looking at their torque curves and everything else, in all the DDs, whether it's the 13, the 15, I don't have much experience around the 16, but I know that 1400, they don't like to be above there. So usually you can do fairly decent, but 1250 down there, they like to be down.
Hey, let me jump in here.
The lower, the better.
I'm not paying attention because I'm trying to make sure we get this handled. What is the question here? Do we already own the 16, or is the question about buying one?
I own it. I just recently bought it due to when I'm pulling the four axle, I'm sitting around the 120,000 pound range.
The 15 would handle that all day long, just beautifully.
Yeah, you're at 245 overall when you're in high gear. So 60 when you can is where it's going to be.
Hey, Joel?
You.
Yes, sir.
What are your thoughts here on a 16-liter for that kind of weight?
Me personally, I'd run away from it. But,
yep.
Right.
I get it.
Some
guys just want the power. And yeah.
That's what he has. So,
right.
No, I know, but there's a lot of other people listening that might make that same decision someday.
Yeah, on that combination, because it's one, it's not aero, you're not aero to begin with. The closer you can stay down around 60, the happier it's going to be. 57, 59, 60. Can it do more than that? And the engines are really not happy when you get them above 1400. So it better be paying real well, and there better be a good reason for being in a hurry to be above 1400.
Okay, yeah, because right now I'm running 66 down the highway at 13.5, and it seems to be happy there. When I drop her down around 12, she seems to like to buck a little bit.
Well, hold on. What size tires do you have that you're down at that RPM? Because I would have thought you'd have been closer to 1400 already at that point.
I got the 22.5 low pros.
Ooh, okay. It's been a while since I've been in those gear ratios. I mean, like,
yeah. And 09. What happened is my other truck, the transmission went out, and it was going to be over $20,000 to put a new automatic transmission in it. And I was looking at upgrading the truck anyway, so this is the truck that I ended up buying due to so I could finish my contract. That was the load I had on, and it wasn't ideal. I wanted to have a lot lower gear ratio, a lot higher gear ratio, but this is what happened, and now I'm just trying to make the best of it and working on trying to get the maximum fuel mileage.
Yep. The farther down you take that RPM on that, the happier it's going to be. I don't know as much on the DDs, but I know on the DD16, I know the 15-liter max torque is at 900, and it's probably somewhere down in that neighborhood as well. It's a fairly straight line on most of the DD series up to 1400, and then it starts falling off like a ski slope. So...
That's what I needed to know, and like I said, it's what I got, and I'm just trying to do the different things to get the maximum fuel mileage out of it, and
How's it doing pulling those kind of weights already?
Oh, it's doing wonderful. I mean, it's got all the torque I need, and pull it out. When I was pulling the belly dump last week, and now I'm on the open highway pulling the flatbed, when I'm pulling the belly dump, coming out of the gravel pit, when you it has all the torque you need to come out of there, where on that with that automatic and that DD15, it struggled really, really bad to come out of the pit and everything else. So
here's
200 was taken up.
Here's a thought, and after we end this call, we still have a bunch of calls, but I have an exercise for the three of us. We're going to take an even much more extreme operation, and I'm going to make the argument that you have a big engine that isn't really helping you much and a lousy set of gears that's hurting you all the way through the spectrum. You can't pull it out of the hole. You're not optimal at the top. You're working too hard shifting in the middle, and I think we could set up a much better approach with a 15-liter. So we will
not only that, Kevin, I like to look at what do you spend most of your time of your day doing. I mean,
of course,
it's the one thing I always tell me about. I was with a large grocery store chain because the drivers were complaining about one hill that's in Texas, and we don't have that many hills. And I'm like, how much time do you spend on that hill?
the operation we're going to talk about, the little exercise for the three of us to work our brains on, isn't all that different. I had a very short period of time where I had a partner who was a heavy haul broker. That's all he specialized in. He moved big machines out of Cleveland. And we partnered and we shared an office, so I was around this operation. It was either an 11 or a 13 axle. For some reason, I'm thinking 11, but then 13. So, and this was back when I was younger and I wasn't even paying attention to this stuff, but I learned a little bit about it. And we're, again, talking about still back then running mechanical engines, 350, 400 horse if you hadn't modified anything. And we still had to deliver that freight. It got delivered, so it's doable. Mm-hmm. And the approach I always take with this is if all you keep doing is adding displacement and horsepower and torque, but you're so limited on your gears, it's a horrible approach. I'd rather take the lower horsepower, less displacement, more efficient, and gear it right. Joel, Henry, what do you think the same
Absolutely.
Way about that?
Who gets this really right, and when I say they get it really right, it's almost by accident, is your bulk tanker people, because they're getting rid of horsepower, everything they can, just to be able to haul more weight, right?
Right, and they still get the freight delivered all the time.
And the funny thing is they get it right not because of themselves. It's really in spite of themselves.
And if you want to hear an extreme case, and it was in Ohio, and it was in Richfield, right in that area where I worked out of, and it made the newspapers, somebody tried to move a 600,000-pound load without a permit.
I remember that.
How'd that end up?
Do you remember that one, Joel?
What did you say about that?
They had a truck pushing and one pulling, and they were trying to run it at night, and they got pulled over just outside of Norwalk is where they got popped for that. I remember that.
That is the exact story. You're right.
Yep.
What I found interesting.
Runner at night. What the hell?
Yeah.
When the truck shortage was so great, Kevin, a dealer up in Michigan had sold some used ex-Meyer 13-liter grocery store spec trucks to people hauling Michigan specials.
And
they're thrilled with them because they're knocking it out of the park.
Right. Joe, you know what's crazy?
What's that?
That you and I both remember one story like that from 30 years ago.
I remember that plain as day. I remember when that happened. Everybody was talking about it. Yep.
So
one pushing, one pulling, right through the middle of the night.
Yep. And they tried to sneak it at night with no permits.
Yep.
Yeah.
What could go wrong?
So when I put out those numbers about fuel mileage this morning, and the more extreme, the worse the fuel mileage is, the bigger the opportunity is, somebody sent this back to me. And he said, Kevin, I'd love to see you improve the mileage on a guy pulling a rock crusher cone with a T-800 or the like or similar. They gross about 200,000. They're oddly shaped, 13 axles, 15 wide, 15 high, 150-ish long. This doesn't really matter to me, but it tells me what they typically do this stuff with. Trucks are usually 600 horsepower, 2050 torque, 18 speed, 410s on big rubber, and they're lucky to see 2 miles to the gallon at 60 miles an hour or so. Now, if your brain was working like mine, I immediately ignored the tractor up for now and thought the low-hanging fruit here are all these axles and tires. If we can make minor improvements in rolling resistance, minor improvements in mechanical resistance, think of the possibility of all the wheel bearings adjustments.
I was going to say, by a Dr. Preload, you go from 2 to 3 just off the Dr. Preload.
Yeah. So talk about a return on your investment. What you pay for that Dr. Preload probably saves you $20,000 in the first year.
Yes, absolutely.
Yep,
absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yep. Hey, just real quick here, Henry. I looked up the power curve on the 600 2050 DD16, and he said he was running around 1,300 RPM. So at 1,300 RPM, that truck's making 507 horsepower. If I take the D13 TC at the 500, 1950 at 1,300 RPM, it makes 482 horsepower. I mean, they're very, very close. In the RPM range that he's running. So I'm sure the DD15 is going to be real close to that as well. This thing doesn't make 600 horsepower till it's out to 1,800 RPM is where it makes 600 horsepower. So he's never coming close. Right, he's never coming close to using that 600 horsepower. So a lot of this is just placebo effect. I've got a 600, and it makes me feel good. It puts a big smile on my face. This is what's going on.
And you know how bad this happens? I was just in a case, Joel, and you'll appreciate this, but one of the most misunderstood engines is the 400 1750, whether it's the 13 or the 15 liter. And they're like, well, it's only got 400 horse, but it's down there where you use it, right? The other one that I got a kick out of just recently, they had trucks with 216 direct, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the drivers are thrilled that they pull better now that they put them in 264 overdrives. Which makes them a 205 now.
You got to love it.
but half of it's in a person's mind. On those ones with the 400 downspin that they say don't pull well enough, I'm like, just change the sticker on the side of the engine. It'll be fine.
Mm-hmm. There's no doubt.
All right, everybody. There are some people right now that are going to have a case of FOMO because we are all sold out on the CMC.
Awesome.
Yes. I'm excited.
Awesome. Nice.
So, Joel, going back to this crazy operation here,
mm-hmm.
Would you have any trouble speccing a 13-liter Volvo knowing the drivetrain you have available to do this?
No, none at all.
I think it would be an awesome truck to do it with.
Yep, absolutely.
Absolutely. So as soon as he sends me this challenge, I'm like, man, I am going to knock this out of the park, and I don't even have to look at the truck. I can. There's so much I'm going to be able to do with the trailer, tires, bearings. Could we lighten up some lubricants in here maybe? And I've got all kinds of ideas. The next message he sends me, you have to ignore the trailers because they're all rentals.
Oh. Well.
There you go.
Still.
I mean, yeah. I mean, you're still going to gain some. There's no doubt, but it's the trailer and that operation where you're going to make up the difference just because of the sheer number of wheel bearings. And, you know, a lot of them are going to be out of adjustment. There's no doubt about that. And the tires and there's a whole lot that could be done right there for sure.
That's one of the things, Kevin, that I missed the most about flatbed. Cause everybody was like, aerodynamics don't matter in flatbed. No, they matter as much or more.
Let's think about this. I get it. Equipment is expensive, but trailers last a long time, and they, even with all these wheels and tires, the maintenance is only in your wheels and tires. There's not that much else that's going to break or go wrong, so maintenance cost isn't huge. This may be probably the worst operation to rent trailers in because rental companies don't take care of anything. You probably got the some of the worst tires. They buy cheap because it's not their trailer. They don't have to use it or put up with it. They're just renting it to you. You're right, Joel. The wheel bearings are probably a mess. I can't imagine how much profit they are giving up by renting that trailer.
Right.
Especially in an application like that.
And here's the problem. I've been talking about this lately. Sometimes when you have too much revenue coming in the door, you make stupid decisions, and this is a case. I guarantee you they're like, well, who cares? We make $82 a mile. Okay, why don't we go work on the expenses then?
Right. Yeah, there's no doubt. Why give the money away?
Yeah, I just got distracted again because I just got another message about the CMC and I'm a little pissed off. I'm not going to talk about it, but I'm going to go make sure that this is correct. We're going to grab a couple more calls and then we're going to run out of time and we're kind of slammed. But let's go to Kevin in Texas. And Joel and Henry, you guys are on your own because I'm going to be furiously texting again.
All righty.
Hey guys, how you doing?
All right.
Well, I guess Kev, I'll make it quick. That way, y'all can get off here so Kevin can go deal with that CMC. He always says that the 05s, 6s, and the 7s were the worst trucks. I don't agree. I think it's the 8s, 9s, and the 10s that were just absolute trash because of all that extra stuff that they put on there. But my first truck was an 05 International 9400 Eagle, and it had I think it was 335 rears, and it had a 13-speed double over with the ISX Cummins. And the only issue I ever had with that thing was I replaced the EGR valve after I'd had it for about 300,000 miles, and at that point it had right at a million, and they had in-framed it at about 700,000, so it had 1.2 whenever I replaced that EGR valve. But I drove that thing for 4 years. I paid $18,500 for it, turned around and sold it to a buddy of mine for $18,500, which I'd pretty much rebuilt everything. And he's still driving that thing today with 1.4. And that goes back to a call that he had, I think it was yesterday or maybe, no, it was Tuesday, I think it was, with Bruce and them. But this guy was going to get this $40,000 old 6 model. It was horrible. But the best I could ever get out of mine, I could get 6.5, which I pull a hopper bottom, so it's trash and arrows dynamics as far as, well, the truck wasn't the best either. But I made a lot of money with that truck and got my money back out of my initial cost of it other than what I put in it. But I just think that maybe a lot of it is just, and I just got really lucky, but I made a lot of money with that truck, and it didn't really cost me a lot of money in maintenance or anything. But then another thing, Joel, I'm the guy that call that gets in your messenger every now and then about the catalyst and about the about the hot shot, which I do use the hot shot now. And and also I'll say, oh, well, that's why, because you're running light. I'm not bagging on you at all, brother. I bought this 23 TC, V13 TC 760. Mm-hmm. It's got the 12-speed I-shift and 247 gears. I really, really wanted the I-torque with the 13.
Mm-hmm.
But I got this truck. I got it out the door for $167,500 with a 4-year basically bumper to bumper. Right. It had 35,000 miles on it, and that's what I was going to tell Kevin. I kind of took both of y'all's advice. I just fell into this. I just called them one day up there at North Little Rock, and they said, well, we just got some trucks in on consignment. And what had happened is back when the rates were sky high, they got into trucking without really knowing a lot about it. So the rates started dropping, and they started panicking. So I said, cha-ching!
Yeah, there you go.
Right.
Well, here's something you might not know. If you take both of our advice, you save twice as much.
Right. And it didn't even cost me anything but a little time where I wasn't going to be learning anything anyway, staring out the windshield.
There you go.
But I have noticed, and since 35,000 miles, it's got not quite 100 on it. I have noticed that whenever I stopped using the Pittsburgh Power catalyst and switched over to the Hot Shot, I have noticed that little bar, and I don't know how accurate it is, that little bar where it says your suet level. Now, I've never had a – now, I might be having a passive regen, but I try not to idle at all. Sometimes I do have to idle when I'm loading, because I load by my airbag gauge, and you have to get a good, accurate load. You have to have your airbags up. The only thing I don't like about this thing is whenever I'm unloading and you dropping that weight, if I don't leave my key on, it won't let air out of the airbags to compensate the levelization of the difference of the weight.
There is an option for that, and I want to tell you you can turn it on in the parameters, but I'd have to double check that. Like my truck, I have an auxiliary air tank on there just for that, and it sits between the frame rails behind the back of the cab, and it's specifically for that vocational type application to keep the airbags active with the key off.
Right,
but I'll have to see if you can turn on what you're talking about, so the air vent, because you must have the smart suspension on there. If it's not,
you must have the smart valve on.
Do you have an ECS button on the dash where it says ECS?
I have a TCS, which is mud in the snow, which traction control.
Right, that's traction control.
I don't see that button in here on the dash.
Okay. All right. Yeah. If it was the smart suspension, it would have the electronically controlled suspension button on the dash. Let me find out on the parameter thing, and then just hit me up in Messenger while you're giving me hell about the catalyst, and I'll answer you.
Well, what I was saying is I noticed. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead. I want to get to something before I forgot it, but that's all right. I'll keep it on my tip of my tongue.
Okay. Well, what I was saying, Joel, I've noticed that that soot level, now it doesn't get high, but it has raised a little bit. And I was wondering since, and I don't know if a 247 rear would be considered a downsped.
It's right at the beginning of what we call downsped nowadays. So yeah, you're right there.
Okay. So, what I was saying is I noticed that it has come up a little bit, which I mean it always goes back down whenever I drive during the day, but I don't drive a lot of, our average load I would say is probably anywhere from 300 to 400. Every now and then you can get out there and stretch your legs, you know, 600-mile day. But most of the time I'm loading, unloading, and trying to get someplace to reload. And that's where – that's what – I mean, I can – like my last tank was 8.7, but I had plenty of time. I run 60-mile an hour. But I can't – I can't on mine – If I run at like 57, it'll stay in 11th, and I'll reach over there and hit it and put it back in 12th, and then it'll stay there for a little bit. But am I still going to get decent fuel mileage in 11th and direct?
No, you want to run it in overdrive as long as the truck will pull it, and there is what they call an auto return to economy feature on your truck, so whenever you shift it manually, it's automatically going to go back to the gear that you shifted out of, and you can disable that, so when you manually bump the gear, it will stay there without returning back to the previous gear.
Okay,
so that's,
well,
that's all in the parameters.
Okay, well, if I now I live it in, I leave it in EE.
Yeah,
I live it in EE.
Exactly. Yep.
So, because, I mean, I'm only pulling 80,000. Now I'll pull Ranger Hill. I don't know if that's the same hill you were talking about, Bruce, but – I mean, not Bruce, but I don't know if that's the same hill. It's in Texas. It's right on I-20, and I live out there. So I have to pull that hill. But this thing pulls – I mean, it slows down. But, I mean, I can leave it in a double EE and not have any issues getting up the hill. But every now and then,
nice.
I'll kind of like – I kind of leave it in that – I'll put it in that P and just leave the cruise on. And I can still pull that hill at 52, 53 mile an hour, and that's at 80,000. I mean, and I'm right at 80 all the time unless I'm empty.
Yeah.
So, but, no,
yeah,
man, whenever
get,
I say –
get right with it in performance.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't leave it like there because my butthole starts hurting a little bit because I think of all the dollar signs going out the bottom of the truck. So I don't leave
it
very often. But But, yeah, I absolutely love this truck. Like I said, there's a few things I don't like, and it's that suspension. And I'll just leave my key on because, I mean, and I love my electric APU. I absolutely love that thing will frost your butt.
Nice.
That's all I got.
Well, good.
What was you going to say, Henry?
Well, the thing I wanted to mention when we were talking about what years are bad of the truck. And, yeah, there was some problem childs out there. But, you know, I think, and Joel, I think you might agree with this. To me, there wasn't so many bad engines as there was bad diagnoses from the technicians of the time because it was all new. I know of a lot of them that turned into disasters because of misdiagnosis of a problem that built into bigger problems.
Henry, what you're talking about is something that we embraced very, very early on. I mean, right at the beginning when the emission systems came out, when we went from the D12 to the D13, we said, look, everybody else was delete. These can't work. It can't be done. And we said to ourselves, bullshit, we're going to invest the time and money. And it was thousands and thousands of dollars we had to invest in training. So we understood those systems very early on. And for about 5 years, from like 2006 to 2011, I swear to God, we were one of the very few fleets in the country that just didn't have any problems. I mean, we've done very, very well, but we spent a lot of money up front to learn that, and it was definitely a learning curve and worth every penny in my estimation. But, yeah, I think you're right, Henry. As, you know, more and more people are starting to understand emission systems, it's becoming commonplace knowledge, and your average mechanic is really starting to understand what's at work here. And, have the engines gotten better? They absolutely have, but the knowledge base has just gotten so much better, too, across a lot more mechanics, and that helps for sure.
Example I'll give, and this is coming from somebody I know that's pretty far up and deals with a lot of these problems. In the case of a Detroit, yeah, I guess Volvo's the same on that, with the one box, the dreaded one box. There's very little that can go wrong with the one box.
It's a fairly simple operation. And his big mm-hmm. thing was before he left them replace a one box, you had to find out what took it out. And it was usually something upstream, like an overfueling fuel injector. You know, mm-hmm. people to keep good track of their fuel records tend to not have a problem with that. But, you know, they put another one box in without fixing the problem. Then, I have to put another one box. Now they wash down a cylinder on the engine. Now they have to overhaul the engine. And it would have been simple at the beginning just to put a fuel injector in and nothing was wrong.
So here's my perspective on this. 6, 7, 5, 6, 7 was, remember, I'm not dealing with a fleet like you and your brother where you had control mm-hmm. and make decisions, or Henry, you where you're doing this. I'm mm-hmm. taking phone calls from people have never seen this stuff, and they're lost and they're pissed off, and the shops were clueless. That was my biggest issue. You threw this stuff at us, and you're using as your guinea pigs, and I get it, the government forced you early, and it, the whole thing was a mess. So from where I sat, I spent way too much time on those years, but mm-hmm. Joel, like you guys, I was working with Pittsburgh Power, and we immediately saw, we've got to figure this out, because the dealers don't know, the mechanics don't know, it's a mess. Mm-hmm. So by the time the 08 came out, we had mm-hmm. gotten on board, and we had figured out a lot of things, and we were making things a lot better. So for me, it was mm-hmm. the 5, 6, and 7s that were a nightmare, and by 8, we had caught up with some knowledge and just kept getting better and better every year. So for me, that memory of those three model years, and remember, that was also the time of the horrendous Cummins cam issues.
Mm-hmm.
So that was what I was living during those times. And by the time we got to 08, I didn't like them, but we were at least saying, hey, look, we know how to eliminate some of these problems. By the time we got to the next change in 11, we had pretty much had it figured out, and we at least had answers for people. It drove me crazy to keep getting calls and going, I know it sucks, but I don't know what to do. And by 08, I didn't have to say that anymore. I at least had some answers.
I remember going into this stuff very early, and, you know, my brother benchmarks against other fleets that's about the same size, and they all were just giggling because we were spending all this money training techs and investing it in the shop. And they're like, oh, no, we're just going to let the dealers take care of this because nobody understood it. And you're an idiot. You're a fool for taking care of this. And most of the fleets were running Cummins Power at that time. And, I mean, we thought initially that they were just bullshitting us about all the problems that you mentioned, the cams. I mean, they were lucky to go 300,000-400,000 miles, and they were pulling heads off. And we still to this day have not had to overhaul Volvo Power, period, in our fleet. We have never done it, had to do it in frame on
that is
any of our
incredible
Volvo Power.
I love that.
Yeah. So, you know, we spent the money, we done the homework, and, you know, right out of the gate, we were hearing all this feedback, and literally we thought, now they can't be having that many problems. And,
oh, yeah, they were.
We were damn fortunate we made the decision that we made. I know me and my brother were both as nervous could be because we were spending money we didn't have. I mean, we were spending a ton of money to train people and get that shop up and running, but I'm so glad that we done it.
I just thought of something because I would say it was a brilliant decision to train your own techs. And it's funny.
Yeah.
Here seems to be a pattern. The rest of the industry is looking at us and calling us morons. We're probably on the right track.
You're probably doing the right thing. That's exactly right. Just do the opposite of what the crowd is doing, and you're generally going to be okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
All right, guys, any final words? I got to go put out fires before they come infernos.
You take care of fires. I got to get ready to get down to Matt's. I'm going to actually be down there probably Sunday night or early Monday morning. When are you going to roll in down there?
I roll in late Monday night, and I will be over at the convention center probably all day Tuesday doing dry runs on technology and mics. So if you want to come over, I will probably be in whatever room we're having our event in all day Tuesday.
Yeah, I'll text you or call you. I done an interview with Brent the other day, and he said he's going to be in the area. I'll get a hold of him, and I'll see what we can do.
Here's something. Yep. I'm pretty sure we have on Tuesday after we get done, and I think it's like 4 o'clock, we're having a little get-together with anybody who is signed up and just wants to stop by. It's nothing major. You two are invited to that.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Get there Tuesday evening or else first thing Wednesday morning.
All right.
Gotcha.
We're just going to wrap this up then. We will see you
awesome.
Soon. Joel, I'm looking forward to meeting you. I mean, I just thought about this the other day. If somebody
it's never been a face-to-face, right?
But it doesn't feel like that.
No, I hear you. I hear you.
And then it dawned on me, and I don't remember if somebody said something, and I thought, I've never met Joel. That seems odd.
Well, we'll take care of that this trip for sure.
That's right.
There you go.
Looking forward to it.
So,
Henry, I've seen you plenty of times. Still looking forward to it, though.
But, we'll all get together while we're down there.
When me and Kevin stand next to each other, it's like twins.
Oh, it is hilarious. You know what we should get? You know, like they have those T-shirts that points to an arrow to the right or left, and it says, I'm with stupid.
There you go.
Not that it's going to say I'm with stupid, but our arrows, like mine is going to have to go up and to the right, and yours is going to have to go down and to the left.
There you go.
Oh, geez.
Well, as long as I'm to the right and you're to the left.
Whatever that is. Yeah. Whatever that is. All right. All right. We will see you there. I am looking forward to it. I've got to get out of here. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey.